It's if I may.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is Tuesday, May 24th, 2016, and I'd like to open the committee on the Interim Committee for the House Energy and Environment. We are going to be talking about a few different things today. We're going to start off with ocean issues on a follow-up to a conference that happened a little bit earlier last month, and then talk about small-scale renewable energy projects. I know that there's been a lot of interest from different folks on the committee for that. And then we will spend the latter part of the hearing on air quality issues, talking about what's happening throughout the state and also in the Portland metro area. So with that, I'm going to open the informational meeting for the ocean issues. And we have some folks who are going to be coming up. Louise Soliday is here, and Dr. Francis Chan, and Dr. Jack Barth. And we were going to have Senator Roblin give a little intro on the importance of ocean issues, but he got called away. So, Rep. Boone, would you like to say a couple
words? Yeah, sure. And I'll just say Louise Soliday is the executive director of the Oregon Ocean Science Trust, which was formed some years ago with a bill from Senator Roblin. Dr. Francis Chan, who is an associate professor and senior research, College of Science, Oregon State, go Beavs. And Dr. Jack Barth, who is a professor and associate dean for research, College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at, again, Oregon State University. And we know very little about the ocean. I know even these professionals know more than we do, but I bet you they would even tell you there's still much more to find out. And so the ocean basically, in my humble opinion, and I've been having this opinion since 1969 when I started in oceanography at University of Washington, has been a very interesting, always changing, always something happening, but it's an integral part of our lives. And I am very pleased. I'm sorry I missed the conference last month, but I'm very pleased that you're going to be giving an update on it because I've been wondering what happened. So with that, I will let the chair call on you as prep.
Go ahead. Anyone can start first.
So Louise Soliday, executive director of the Ocean Science Trust, and that's a volunteer position, just so you know. The Ocean Science Trust was created without budget, so we are trying to make do and get things up and running without resources to really help do that. As Representative Boone mentioned, the trust was created in statute in 2013. There were some amendments to that statute in 2014 that corrected some issues that were making it difficult to find volunteers to serve. In October of last year, the land board appointed the members of the trust. We've had two meetings since then. We've adopted a set of bylaws. But probably the most important thing that's happened since we were created is 2 weeks ago, we held a two-day science summit where we brought together 45 of the smartest people we know about Oregon's nearshore environment and agency managers to really talk about what priorities we have, priority needs we have for nearshore research and monitoring. And over the course of the 2 days, I think we got to a good place with the scientists and the agency folks. And we have a document which we're going through, is going through an editing process right now. The Science Trust will meet in June and hopefully adopt some final report to take out for public comment. We hope to actually have an adopted set of priorities by the end of this year. We expect to be in front of the legislature for the 17-19 biennium asking for some budget resources to help fund those priority needs. I do want to just talk briefly about the priority areas that were identified. While there's been quite a bit of ocean research, still not enough, but quite a bit outside of the 3 mile area, there's been very little done inside of Oregon's nearshore. And that's why the Nearshore Task Force recommended the creation of this Ocean Science Trust to actually try and fund a grant program to get some of the research that needs to be done out there done. There are lots of agencies who make management decisions in the nearshore. In my former life, I was the director of the the Department of State Lands and had to make decisions about wave energy siting placements, undersea cable placements, other activities that go on out there. And we had very little information about the biology, the chemistry, the physical environment that we were making those decisions in. And that's still the case today, where we have agencies making decisions without really good information about what's going on in the nearshore environment. The four areas that were identified is that we need better information about the distribution and abundance of the species that occupy the nearshore and the habitats that they occupy. We've done a great job of doing some seafloor mapping, but we have a whole lot of the area of the nearshore that has not been mapped yet, and so we know little about that environment. There has been some chemical and physical measurements, and the two scientists here will talk about some of that. So we know a bit about that in some parts of the nearshore, but not in enough parts to really know what's going on out there. The second area where we've identified priorities is to look at the species and habitat associations and interactions in the nearshore that inform ocean health, really looking at ecosystem interactions and how changes in species or changes in habitat or changes in the environment out there affect other factors in the nearshore. The third area is sort of the human dimension, how people are affected by the resources and how people affect the resources in the nearshore. And so when we brought the scientists together, we included sociologists and economists because we think that's an important area that we need to look at as we're making decisions out there. And then the fourth area is this large area, the effects of climate change and ocean acidification on species and their habitats, and how those key stressors influence ecological function and species in the nearshore habitats and will affect nearshore habitats in the future. And there's a lot of work that's starting to be done in that area, but a lot more that needs to be done. So in terms of next steps for us, as I mentioned, we are going to we hope to finalize this report at our June meeting. I'm in the process of editing a report, the draft report from the summit. We do meet on June 8th. I do want to mention that we are coordinating closely with the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. They have offered to serve as a public forum for the work that we're doing, and so I'll be presenting the report to them at their June 13th meeting and hopefully getting public feedback from them as well as all of the folks who follow the OPAC process. We also are in the process of starting to catalog what's already being done in the nearshore so we don't duplicate efforts and we can figure out if there are some projects that are already underway that we can build on to get more information in a wider area of Oregon's territorial sea. And so we've got a couple of folks, one of our trust members who is a scientist who is helping to do that, as well as the Oregon Sea Grant Fellow who's in the governor's office. So the two of them are starting to reach out through the internet and to individual scientists who are doing work in the nearshore area so that we know who's doing what, where they're doing it, what they're doing it for, how they're doing it, how often, so we have a good sense of what's already going on out there. So as we're looking at funding grants in the future, that we're looking at funding things that are new or expanding the areas where work is already being done to get additional information that we need. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I don't know if you want all of us to go or you want to do questions in between.
We can do questions after everyone. Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. And I'll follow up, Luis, by talking, maybe giving a concrete example of how the Ocean Science
Trust...
Can you
introduce yourself for the record? That's okay.
I'm Francis Chan. I'm a marine ecologist at Oregon State University. And I'll follow up, Luis, by giving a more concrete example of the kinds of science that the Ocean Science Trust has the ability to make a difference on. I'm a marine ecologist, and I've been part of a marine research community in our state that's been working to study how ocean ecosystems work and how they might change. And in particular, my research focuses on the twin challenges of ocean acidification, so something about changes in the carbon chemistry of seawater, and hypoxia, so something about low oxygen zones in the ocean. You know, in many ways, these should be really, really boring topics, right? Because it goes without saying that the ocean is vast and well-buffered. And you know, it wasn't that long ago that we didn't expect changes in these fundamental aspects of ocean chemistry. There's no way we could be changing these things. But unfortunately, that turns out to be the case where we're changing the pH, so pH is lowering the ocean, and we're also changing the amount of oxygen, so we're seeing a greater probability of seeing low oxygen zones off our coast. So this has happened. And when we have rising CO2 in the atmosphere, pH declines, and it's making it harder for animals like oysters. And we actually just heard last week, Dungeness crabs, it's making it harder for oysters and crabs to grow and survive. The study just came out last week on the crabs, which has big implications for our state. Ocean climate is also changing, and it's starting to lower oxygen level. And basically, in some places, the levels are declining so low that animals have to move or they are suffocated. So, and we've seen this in our state. So what does it mean for us in Oregon? Unfortunately, our state has been at the epicenter of the early impacts from ocean acidification and hypoxia. This is a global issue, but unfortunately, this is something that we can see every summer along our coast. As Mark Weigert, the owner of the Whiskey Creek Hatchery, and all the other oyster farms that dot up and down the coast that depend on his business to grow oysters, ocean acidification has already hit his business hard. At the same time, every summer, my research, we go out there and we deploy ocean sensors. And instead of just looking at the changes in the ocean, I'm looking for when and where low oxygen zones are getting too low. I'm now in the detection business of looking at low oxygen zones. So the global changes that we've been thinking about and are grappling with, they're no longer distant or abstract. They're here in our state. How have we responded as a scientific community? The state of Oregon has partnered with Washington, California, and British Columbia and formed a task and tasked a panel of 20 scientists from across the West Coast to really assess the state of science behind ocean acidification and hypoxia and really provide recommendations for actions. I co-chaired that panel, and our report was released just last month in April. The full document in all its glory is available online, but I want just to share you some of the more salient findings. And I'll try to cut it down to two. The first is that instead of viewing ocean acidification and hypoxia as this intractable global problem that, by and large, we're just going to wait and let it happen to us, there are actually a number of local actions that can be taken to better prepare our state for the changes ahead. And this includes exploring the use of coastal vegetations, such as seagrass beds or kelp forests, that naturally take up CO2 to lessen the exposure to ocean acidification. We can also bolster the ability of marine life and ecosystems to resist OAH. And what that might mean is that we want to preserve the parts of the gene pool where the individuals that are naturally resilient to the changes of head are actually able to pass on their genes. The second point, the second key message is use science to your advantage. And this is going to sound completely unsurprising coming from a scientist, right? But I think the key point is that let's be smart about how we move ahead, because when we think about what to do, well, blanket approaches might not get you where you want to go, and if anything, we can waste a lot of resources along the way. So one size doesn't fit all, and we really need to turn on the high beams to know where are the places that are most vulnerable and where are the places that are really most amenable to these kinds of local solutions that we like to explore. I think it's particularly fitting that we're having this conversation here in Oregon, in Salem. And I say this because the panel that I just co-chair really began with a phone call from the Dungeness crab fisherman who asked, why are there dead crabs in the pots? That should not be. It also began with the troubling news from Whiskey Creek Hatchery. Now, when fishermen or oyster growers with 40 decades of experience tell us that something is wrong, this is weird, scientists listen. That's what makes it really interesting to us. When someone says, I haven't seen this in 4 decades, then that really sets off the detective story process. Now, this isn't an issue that we can solve with any one step. But if we don't start taking steps, it's going to make it harder and harder for us to get to our goals down the line. But fortunately, we don't have to be behind the curve on this one. And I say that it's an exciting time because we're in a moment where we have a newly constituted Ocean Science Trust that can help us to really turn on the high beams. We have a very deep bench of scientific expertise, but also expertise and experience and support from industry and agencies. And we can really take on that, tap into that collaborative spirit to take on the global challenges ahead for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Jack Barth. I'm a professor of oceanography and associate dean for research at Oregon State University in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. So I wanted to cover three topics briefly today. One is something Dr. Chan alluded to, the cooperation between fishermen and scientists as we observe our ocean. The second is, how do we really keep our fingers on the pulse of the ocean? How do we make measurements out there? And lastly is this new marine studies initiative at Oregon State University that's a new way to really get ahead on all these issues. So let me start with the Fishermen and Scientists Roundtable. And it comes from what Dr. Chan was saying, that some of the earliest signs of ocean change are happening here because of our unique oceanography and the fact that we're pretty far northern latitude and the jet stream sweeps across us and we're seeing changes today. Fishermen are out on the water a whole lot more than Dr. Chan and I are. We try to get out, but they're out there all the time. Valuable observers of change and folks that we want to stay involved with. Partnerships work. So it was mentioned about Whiskey Creek where there was a challenge. Academic scientists worked with industry to solve that problem. So we gathered 14 scientists, 14 fishermen. Senator Roblin came with us, Louise Soliday, and we met in Newport at the Hatfield Marine Science Center, and we talked about what were the fishermen seeing out there, any changes from ocean acidification or warming or hypoxia, and what did the scientists know, and it was really a great back and forth. The fleet is very interested in helping with this. They have the platforms, they have the eyes out there, they can provide valuable information, and we want to find a way to make that happen. Broad enthusiasm from them to be part of the solution. So really the message is very brief on this one, is that as we move forward with the Oregon Ocean Science Trust or any of these activities, let's encourage and find ways for the fishing fleet and the scientists to be involved together in solving these challenges. So the second issue is, how do we really keep our eyes on what's going on out there? How do we monitor the vital signs of the ocean? And in addition to the fishermen that are out there, as scientists, what we can do is we have these amazingly sophisticated platforms that we can put sensors on. So what are we measuring? We're measuring temperature, the salinity, the water velocity, which is very important to operations on the ocean. We're measuring the dissolved oxygen, the pH, that is the acidity of the water. We're measuring the amount of chlorophyll. That's how much plankton's out there. Sometimes that plankton can overbloom and be harmful. So we need to have sensors that measure all of those things. We have them, and the way we've been deploying them are on these moorings. And these are buoys at the sea surface, and these things are gigantic, probably twice the height of this room. They're loaded up with wind sensors, temperature sensors, pH sensors. They generate their own power from the wind and solar cells, and they have satellite links back to shore. And this is what's new, is we can get that data back now. We don't have to wait 4 months or 6 months. We can bring it into our laboratories, and we can bring it into the classrooms, and we can bring it to interested citizens. Now, Louise mentioned that we're not observing all the ocean. We're certainly not. We've constructed the Ocean Observatories Initiative arrays offshore of Oregon. This is the National Science Foundation's largest civilian investment in oceanography. And Oregon is very much a big part of it. We've constructed an array of sensors off Newport, Oregon. And then we have a fleet of underwater robots flying from Cape Falcon past Newport down to Coos Bay that are out there 24/7, 365, sending us data about the ocean. The data is freely available to everyone. No longer is it the scientists holding it and getting publications. So we want to welcome people to use that data, ask questions, get the next generation involved. Louise also mentioned that we're not measuring as much on the near shore as we might. So that's the water that's basically 25, 30 fathoms of water, 50 meters of water into the beach. It's a hard place to work, but that's Oregon's state waters, and we need to get more sensors there. Francis is actually putting sensors in the intertidal for pH, so we know exactly what's happening on the rocks, and we're trying to do this from border to border. So what are we seeing lately? We know the ocean changes our weather, changes our climate. 2015 was the warmest year on record. The first 4 months of 2016 were the warmest of any on record. We've had this so-called warm blob offshore. Many of you probably heard of that. It's persisted now for a couple years. It alters the exchange of heat with the atmosphere. It changes where the winds blow. It affects how much snowfall we get, how much precipitation for our crops. The ocean really does drive our climate. And so knowing where that water is and how it affects our Oregon is critical. We're tracking the El Nino as it hits its peak and then fades into a La Nina. So the last point today I'd like to share is this new way of approaching this, and that's with the Marine Studies Initiative. And I brought some of our vision documents I'd like to leave with you. And it really goes off the fact that the ocean's key to life on our planet. I mentioned the climate, but every second breath you breathe comes from plankton producing oxygen in the ocean. Something like 90% of goods and services move by the ocean. It's absorbing CO2 for us, doing a very useful service. So Oregon State and its statewide partners, border to border again, are attacking this in a new way. Instead of just one college working on this, we're going to span the entire university. So all 11 colleges, not just my earth, ocean, and atmospheric sciences, but we want the College of Science, pharmacy, business, College of Agricultural Sciences. But even newer ideas, the College of Liberal Arts. There's so many students out there that want to have a better understanding of how our planet works, and they're the ones that are going to be finding the solutions and making the decisions. So we started this new project. It's going to have three main topics. We want to have a transformational educational experience. Translation of that is get them out in the field, teach them how to use the tools that we need. We want to advance transdisciplinary marine research, more than one discipline. Physics, biology, policy, economics. And then we want to increase our societal impact. Within that whole idea of transdisciplinary ocean research are these centers of excellence. This is a place where we can gather all the skills of the academic scientists, industry, government agencies, and we can attack pressing problems. You just heard a perfect example in ocean acidification hypoxia. It spans all those fields. So what we would like to think is that a center of excellence on this topic housed within this Marine Studies Initiative would be a perfect way to coordinate research and activities across the state. And importantly, it would coordinate with the Oregon Ocean Science Trust to identify those priorities, to be aware of the data that's available, and also to serve as a place to communicate with other state entities and federal entities that are dealing with this topic. So that's, in a nutshell, the three items I talked about. So cooperation between industry, that is the fishermen and the scientists, the idea of keeping our fingers on the pulse of the ocean with these observations, and then educating the next generation of ocean solution solvers through the Marine Studies Initiative. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Do you have questions for the panel?
Can I go back to school?
Yeah, I know. Rep. Holby.
Thanks. I appreciate the presentation. I, recognize that there's a lot of study that needs to happen in this arena, and I guess reflecting on the severity of this potential issue. At what point do we take our academic study approach and research approach, and I appreciate the comments about we don't want to waste a lot of money by going after solutions that may not be the correct ones, but at what point do, because you can never really prove anything, for certain, it seems like, in science. So at what point do you understand that we have strong enough correlations that will indicate what steps we should be taking to fix this situation, or slow it down, or take steps to, that should be taken just to, address this issue? Because I fear that we wait 50 years for a solution, and then the solution will be too late.
I'd like to have Francis address that. Yeah. He gave a couple of examples of what we could be doing right now.
Yeah. But I'll just say that the big secret is that the ocean acidification is actually quite simple. It's mass balance. It's like accounting. Because when I have this much CO2 in the water, it has to change the pH. So there's nothing very mysterious about it. So we know that changes are ahead. And within my lifetime and my son's lifetime, we're going to see a very different ocean chemistry. But what we're finding out is that there are things that we can do. What we can do is work with Luis and other state agencies to say, okay, we have some certainty that this is going to happen in the next 10, 15 years, and these are the things at risk. And let's think about what are the steps that you can take reasonably today at reasonable cost to get you where you want to be, so that the risk of collapsing fishery will decline, the risk of not having sustainable seafood will decline. So we need to work together. But I would just say, don't trust us scientists. Put us in a room with people that make decisions, and we'll try to come up with the best solutions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is for Luis, but maybe it's for everybody. In the last piece, other than requesting funds, and I'd love to help you with that, you're talking about cataloging existing data and existing research and stuff. How long do you think that will last, and how is that going to be done? Is it as simple as books on a shelf, or?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Boone, so what I've asked Cassina and Jim to do is to develop a spreadsheet that identifies who's doing, what research is being done or monitoring, by whom, where they're doing it, what they're doing it for, and how often, so that we have a sense of what's actually going on already by researchers, by agencies, and others in the nearshore environment. There is some work going on. It's not that nothing's going on in the nearshore. It's limited. And so it's just to get a handle on what's already happening. And it may be that the Ocean Science Trust, should it get resources, and part of the reason for getting state resources is to leverage federal and private dollars, who have told us repeatedly, where's the state investment in its own waters? So they want to see us come up with some skin in the game before they're going to put some skin in the game with us. But to really identify of those things that are already going on, do we need to expand them to a larger geographic area? Do we need to expand them temporarily, so over a longer period of time or more often, in order to get a better handle on what's going on in the nearshore environment? And what things aren't we doing at all that we know we need the information about in order to make good management decisions and good policy decisions moving forward? The whole point of the Ocean Science Trust is to really inform state decision making. So state agencies have responsibility in the nearshore, whether it's DLCD, who adopts the territorial sea plan, or DSL, who makes proprietary decisions, or ODFW, who has to make fishing season decisions. We're making those in an absence of a lot of information that we should have in front of us before we make those decisions. And so the whole idea is get the information that the state agencies need. There's a lot of information you can collect out there that probably isn't going to help inform the state agency. So what we're really focused on as the state's Ocean Science Trust is, what's that information we need for state agencies to be able to make good, informed decisions?
Mm-hmm. Oh, just a quick follow-up.
And
with that in mind, the line, the nebulous line of the 3 miles limit, if there's federal work that's being done out there over the years, how does that integrate, and how much do you take and just assume that, well, it's at this point it's like this, and so we can assume that going inland it'll be whatever?
Yeah, you've hit it exactly. So Francis and I work in a line across those waters. So we know what's going on in federal waters. Yep. We can extrapolate it into state waters and right up to the rocks. We only do that in a couple of places. We've got to get out there at many other places along the coast.
And final follow-up. If you could, would the finishing the seafloor mapping project, would that help you, or is that a completely different thing?
It's very much part of the Oregon Ocean Science Trust priorities is to finish off that habitat mapping.
Thank you.
Although I'll say this, Representative Boone, I want to be a little careful about that. Most of what's not mapped are sandy areas.
Yeah.
So we've mapped all the rocky areas, or almost all of the rocky areas, with the new CARISA money several years ago. And so we've got a good handle on the areas that are rocky. We don't have a good sense of the sandy areas and, you know, elevations and those sorts of things in those areas necessarily. So getting that seafloor mapping complete it is a good idea, so that we have a complete set of information about what the seafloor looks like throughout the territorial sea.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So I want to thank you, all three of you, for coming today. It's been really interesting. I think that, you know, we've heard in the news about things that have had a huge impact, you know, off the coast, and they seem very mysterious, like what caused the blob to be there and what's causing, you know, the starfish to wash up on the shore, and it seems like there's a lot of mystery. So I'm very excited to hear that there's, you know, looking at more research to get more information to help us figure out what's happening and then how we can address it. Dr. Chen, you talked about some of the strategies talked about were really about mitigation. How can we mitigate things that we know are going to be happening because of the increase in the CO2 and that? And I think that that's an important piece. Will the data help us also with the predictability of what's going to happen, to help us predict some of these things too?
Absolutely, because you know, if I know what it looks like today, then I can, it's going to betray my specialty, but I can just do the simple math and I can add on. You know, if we see 100 days where things are good, in 50 years, will we see 100 days where things are good? Or we start to see only 50 days where things are good for growing an oyster or growing a clam or growing a razor clam. So that's exactly the kinds of data that I love to be able to make those reasonable projections, those bounded future estimates.
Well, I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old who will love to know that there are robots across the floor of the ocean that are working, so I'm going to be happy to share that with them. But I appreciate you guys coming in today to share this, and I think that there's a lot of support here in the legislature for the work that you're doing and just knowing how vital the industries are, the marine life and the marine industries for our state. So thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, so the next topic that we're going to be talking about is also one that's very interesting to this group, which is the small-scale renewables. Oh, yeah, she can go ahead and pass those out, make sure that we get those. So we're going to have four, so maybe we'll bring up one more chair. Brian Seekin, Commissioner Les Perkins, Mark Jockers, and David Brown for the small-scale renewable energy projects. And I know Rep. Reardon, Rep. Johnson, Rep. Helm, all of you are very interested in these projects, and I think that what we're here today will help us talk about kind of what the state of these projects are and what might need to be done in 2017.
Glad you're planning for the future.
I'm looking out for you guys.
You are. Job security.
Thank you guys all for being here. You can any one of you can start first.
Okay, I guess that's going to be myself. Thank you, Chairman Vega Peterson, members of the committee. So I'm going to go through some things fairly quickly, then I'm going to turn it over to Les, who needs to go back home and work for the folks that pay his salary. So I'm going to go through some things fairly quick. We're going to kind of bounce back and forth, but if you see him get up and leave, that's you didn't offend him or anything. He just needs to get back home and go to work.
Sure.
So community, small-scale, renewable energy.
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Brian Skain. Thank you. Okay, I'm the executive director of the Community Renewable Energy Association. CREA is, let's see, here we go. CREA is a ORS 190 intergovernmental organization. Our membership includes a variety of people and organizations, including counties. We've got, I believe, 13 Oregon counties, irrigation districts, councils of governments, project developers, for-profit and non-profit businesses and organizations. So it's an interesting bunch of cats to kind of try to keep headed the right direction. The projects that our members support are these small-scale renewable projects. And these projects are interesting, and they're literally everything from soup to nuts. The way I describe it is all of the projects that are statutorily defined as renewable, we like equally. I like all my children equally well, wind, solar, biomass, biogas, you name it. If it's statutorily defined as renewable, we're interested in supporting those kinds of projects. Literally, they exist pretty much throughout the state. This is a map that the Oregon Department of Energy has put together. They asked me to caveat this, that this is a from a preliminary, not officially released document, so if you see something looks a little bit different than this down the line, but you get an idea of the type of projects and where they're located throughout the state. The size of the projects vary significantly from as small as maybe 100 kW or less to as large as 20 megawatts. They're owned by a variety of people, public and private, and they're financed a variety of ways, from projects that are primarily reliant upon public sector support and financing to projects that are almost entirely privately built, private professional services. So it's really hard to characterize them as any one type of thing other than we've kind of established a definition, at least we think that we think it's appropriate that we would define small as being 20 megawatts or less. So what does that mean, and how many of these are out there? Well, they're all over, and from my perspective, as I mentioned, the definition of renewable is sort of statutorily defined. But frankly, there's a lot of uncertainty. As you might expect, some of these projects are so small they tend to fly under the radar. You know, in terms of officially counting, questions with regards to hydro that's non-low impact certified projects that were built prior to 1995. There are a host of definitional issues that really kind of need to be sorted through and determine, you know, how many of these are there and how we're doing in terms of compliance with goals and mandates. So the Oregon Department of Energy is kicking off a process to begin to try to wrestle that to ground, and that's something that CREA really appreciates. We think that's been a long time coming. It's just time to begin to sort of keep score and get a handle, and we do appreciate the work that ODO is doing to try to move that along. So why are we interested? You know, why do I have 13 county members that are interested in supporting this? You know, from our perspective, and I remember when I kind of went through a strategic planning process with the members, I asked fundamentally, are you primarily a renewable advocacy organization, or are you primarily a rural economic development? Most of our counties are in the rural portions of the state, and they kind of wrestled with that a little bit. And the answer is both, but the economic impact part of the discussion is certainly significant. And these small projects have been demonstrated and proved through a variety of studies provide some exceptionally nice economic benefits. Local projects tend to have and rely upon local contractors, local professional service providers. These studies have shown, as you can see here, you know, three and a half times the earnings, 2.5 times the job, 5.2 times the total impact of sort of large absentee-owned projects. So while small, they have a not insignificant impact on local areas. Tax payments, direct jobs, associated earnings.
Excuse me, Ryan, we have a question.
Just real.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Representative Reed.
Could you back up just?
Oh, I hope so. Previous.
Well, it's just the non-local thing. What do you mean? There's some reason you're telling us that the non-local versus more local. What's your...
Because the local projects have been found to provide more local economic impact than projects that are built by large non-local companies. A project that is locally owned and particularly locally financed has more local economic impacts than, say, you know, a project built by EDF or Iberdrola. on a per megawatt basis.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, let's... So, one of the things that I would like to emphasize is I think there's sometimes there's an assumption that small means more expensive, you know, that you know larger projects have bigger economies of scale. And while all this local economic impact stuff is a nice, cute little discussion, aren't these really more expensive? And the answer is not necessarily. One should not assume that a small project has per unit costs that are significantly different than a larger project. And the way I describe that is, you know, if an Iberdrola or a big utility project trips offline at 3 o'clock in the morning, then there's somebody that's paid to be at a desk to deal with that. I'm going to talk a little bit later about Patu Wind. If that project kicks off at 3 o'clock in the morning, the owner gets to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and deal with that. So, you know, there's some pluses and minuses, but one should not necessarily assume that there is a significant price differential that's being traded off by these local economic impacts. And the next point I'd like to make, and if there's one thing I would hope that you could walk away from in this discussion, is that these projects oftentimes have multiple benefits. While certainly they provide power to serve the utility customers throughout the state, very frequently there are multi-purpose benefits that are associated with these projects. And so what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Les Perkins at Farmers Irrigation District, because they have a project that I think really epitomizes this multi-purpose benefit for you. So, Les?
I can do it for you.
Okay. So, I'm Les Perkins. I'm manager of Farmers Irrigation District and in my 16th year as a county commissioner in Hood River, focused on energy and water, natural resources primarily at the commission level. And I also worked for a nonprofit for 10 years, working around the West, developing small-scale energy projects, putting pipes in the ground, installing fish screens, fish passage, that kind of fun stuff. So, go ahead. Just give you a little bit of background. Farmers Irrigation District serves about 6,000 acres of high-value farmland in the Hood River Valley. Like much of Oregon, agriculture is the backbone of our economy. It is the number one piece, with about $120 million a year in farm gate sales. So what many people don't know is that Farmers Irrigation District actually has a couple of renewable energy projects located within our infrastructure. So we have two powerhouses, nameplate capacity of 4.6 megawatts. We produce about 26 million kilowatt hours a year. We've been producing that for nearly 30 years now. And in that 30-year time period, our project has generated close to $45 million in revenue. And what's unique about an irrigation district and a small project like this that's owned within the community is that 100% of that money has stayed in our community. So as an irrigation district, we can really only do two things. We can sell power to the utility and provide water to our customers. And so all of that money that comes from our project goes back into infrastructure. So what that's meant for Farmers Irrigation District is that we've been able to invest in our water infrastructure in ways that other districts can't. So we've put 67 miles of pipeline in the ground in 30 years. We now use half as much water to serve the same number of acres as we did 30 years ago. And that's only possible because we had this hydro revenue to utilize directly and to leverage loan funds. We've also borrowed close to $40 million in loan funds over that time period. Like I said, 100% of that revenue has stayed in the form of construction jobs, infrastructure. It has made Farmers Irrigation District one of the most efficient irrigation districts in the state of Oregon. So one of the other things we've been able to do is we've been able to invest in infrastructure such as centralized pumping. So we actually pressurize our irrigation system now. We've enclosed our entire system in pipes so we don't lose water through leakage through our canals. We're able to utilize low-flow sprinkler technologies. We have centralized filtration systems. All of these things are very advanced and very expensive. So the question comes up quite often is, how likely is this to be repeated other places? Well, in Hood River County, we actually have two districts that do this. Middle Fork Irrigation District produces almost the same number of kilowatt hours. They can tell you just about the same exact story. We have one major district that doesn't have it. They still have 60 miles of open canal. They still use twice as much water. So they're using twice as much water per acre as we are. And it's 100% has to do with the fact that we've been able to invest in our infrastructure. So if you look around the state of Oregon, there's a lot of projects projects that have already been installed, and most of them were installed in the mid-'80s, kind of back in the last window when it made sense to invest in hydropower. But there are a lot of other opportunities. One of the things I did in my previous job was actually go around the West and look at projects and look at the applicability for small-scale hydro. You can look in the Deschutes Basin. There are several projects that could be ready to go within the next year to 3 years in the Deschutes Basin. There's projects in Wallowa County. There's more projects in Hood River County. Basically scattered all over the state, there's the potential to generate power within irrigation and water infrastructure. So the things that keep us from being able to develop these projects are not having contract terms that are long enough. That's always a concern for those of us that have these projects, is that when we renew our contracts, that we're not going to be able to have a contract that we can depend on. If you're going to build a project, you need at least 15 years, more likely 20 years, to finance the project. We have to have favorable rates through PURPA. So those things we have to have. They're essential for these projects to get off the ground. And so as a producer, those are the things that I'm always looking at on the horizon is are we going to be able to maintain rates that allow us to keep these projects running and keep investing in our own systems in our county? And if you don't mind, if there's any questions, I'll happily take them. I apologize for having to leave. I promised to give a watershed presentation 3 months ago. So.
All right. Questions? Johnson, and then we'll get to you.
Just a quick thank you, Les. It is just extremely impressive to me what has been accomplished in the Hood River Valley, and I really appreciate you coming today and sharing that with us.
Thank you. There's people much brighter than I am that did this 30 years ago.
Rep
thanks,
Johnson.
Madam Chair. Yeah, Les, thanks for being here and representing the Valley. There's no question that
reduction in water use.
That long-range plan really was instrumental in allowing the Valley to survive agriculturally in this last really dry year and had come up with a normal pear harvest. You know, you said you guys are using half the water that you were, yep. You would have been without it. So it's key, and I think those are the type of, and obviously that water then can go back in and stay in the stream beds and so forth, which has other public benefits too. As we talk about not just economic but environmental as well. But I guess as we go forward, some of us are going to be working in the interim on this topic. It's really important for, I think, us going into the next session to have a good, clear picture of what the potential possibilities are out there.
Sure.
What the associated costs might be, what the benefits could be, and if CREA could work to try to be as couple of us much specific information as possible between now and then, that would really help us as we move forward and decide just what we do regarding.
Okay.
Know, enhancing, you know, other renewable opportunities going forward. So, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Rep. Bunce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I was on the Water Resource Commission when we started this process.
Thanks.
Those 25, 30 years ago. So, it's great to see it play out in this fashion. The one thing I noticed, I did a quick calculation. You said 120 million farm gate and 6,000 acres. That's roughly 20,000 an acre.
There's 14,000 acres of tree fruit. The district I work for is 5,888 acres. So yes. Over the 14,000 acres of tree fruit, it's about 120 million in farm gate.
Follow up. The point I was going to make is that I've explained to people that utilize water for any source, they're going to have to raise the income generating capacity of that, which whatever they're doing, they need to make more money. So it's great to see this, but am I correct there? It seems to me that orchards and vineyards and walnuts, all the kind of things that translate into higher farm gate dollars appear to be the future. Is that a correct statement, or are you seeing, is there any possibility of raising wheat out there or something that just simply doesn't return that kind of money other than just as a cover crop?
No, I mean, I'd say that the bigger issue is cost of land. One thing that you do see in areas that are lower value agricultural products or things that are grown that have less value than tree fruit is that as you pressurize systems, as you put pipes in the ground, you see a conversion to center pivot systems from flood irrigation, and you start seeing seed crops going in. You start seeing alfalfa instead of just grass hay. And so you actually, by pressurizing irrigation systems, even in areas where you can't grow these really high-value crops, you still see an increase in what's grown in terms of value. So anywhere in the state that you're able to pressurize a system and you're able to actually invest in that irrigation system, you start seeing an increase in the agricultural outputs and the types of crops that are grown.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Commissioner? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are you unwrapping?
Hopefully we got you out here on time.
Perfect.
That worked well. So I mentioned that you saw all kinds of sizes and types of projects, and I think that that's going to be pointed out by the comparison between Les's presentation, which is a sort of a rural agriculture irrigation focused project, to something that's a little more urban and urbane. So again, I think that the comparison between the two really does show the wide diversity of these small renewable projects that that we like to support. So turn it over to Mark Jockers, Clean Water Services, Washington County.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Mark Jockers. I'm with Clean Water Services. I want to tell you a little bit about Clean Water Services and some cogeneration work, energy production work we're doing. Clean Water Services is a water resource management utility that serves about 572,000 people in urban Washington County. We are a county service district. Our board of directors is the Washington County Commission, although we're a separately managed and financed public utility. We've been in business since 1970. We have about four lines of businesses. We do surface water management for pollution prevention and habitat protection, drainage. We do water supply security and planning related to Hague Lake, a Bureau of Reclamation facility. Also manage flow in the Tualatin River itself for fish habitat and water quality purposes. The area that's changed the most in our industry is really the area of what I call resource recovery, which for many, many years was called wastewater treatment. But what has happened over the last 15 years is really a transformation of our industry to look at how do you recover resources from the water that's sent to us. So we clean about 60 million gallons of water a day from 572,000 people and many businesses. And what we're producing is we're producing 60 million gallons of clean water. We are recovering nutrients for both to produce both a wholesale and a commercial fertilizer. And we also produce energy. And energy is really what I want to talk to you about today. Now, energy is a priority for us at Clean Water Services because it is a major operating cost. As a public treatment utility, it's a major component of our costs. Clean Water Services is one of Washington County's largest power consumers and among the top 20 PG's customers. And over the last decade, we've placed a major focus on energy efficiency and generation of clean, renewable power in order to control ratepayer costs, so our sewer pay, ratepayers, recover resources, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, one of the challenges that I think you'll hear from all of us here is energy projects are expensive and typically require long payback periods. I mean, I think the policy leadership and financial incentives and outside investments are really central to our ability to economically invest in energy generation and efficiency. Thanks to the policy leadership of our board and of the legislature, the tools are available for us to make these investments. And we've really forged a partnership with the Energy Trust and the Oregon Department of Energy. We've been able to make shared investments in Washington County's energy future. If you look at, I think that what I'm trying to point out here with this slide is on the last two columns there. The last column is what the payback would be on our investment if no incentives were present. The second last column is what the payback is when incentives come, and these are all incentives. It's a selection of projects that were done over the last 3 years that have come from the Energy Trust. And what you'll see is instead of a payback of 12 years on a project there, it'll be a payback of 2. And our board holds us very tightly to make sure that we have a payback window, typically of somewhere between 7 and 9 years. They want to see a payback on any of these types of investments. If it's outside of that, it's not a wise investment for our ratepayers to make or for us to make. Since 2009, over the last 7 years, Clean Water Services, which includes, we have treatment facilities at Durham, Hillsborough, Forest Grove, and Rock Creek, and also in Hillsborough, has secured about $10 million in outside energy incentive investments and technical assistance, including $5.3 million from the state of Oregon and $4.3 million from the Energy Trust. Together, these incentives and technical assistance have allowed us to deploy more than 100 energy efficiency and generation projects. Now I want to drill down to a very specific example. This is a facility that Representative Helm has visited earlier this year. And 2 weeks ago, our board, Oregon Department of Energy and Energy Trust, dedicated Clean Water Services Durham Renewable Energy and Cogeneration Facility in Tigard. It's a $16.8 million facility. The new facility uses 70,000 gallons of fats, oils, and grease. So this is restaurant grease, right, from food service establishments, formerly a waste. We use that grease collected from restaurants to boost the treatment plant's digester gas production, basically tripling our energy generation. Together with a 403-kilowatt solar system, this 1.7-megawatt system generates more than 11 million kilowatts of renewable energy annually, meeting 60% of our on-site needs at this treatment plant, and also avoiding producing 600 tons of carbon dioxide. Thanks to the investment from ODO and from ETO, we've been able to turn what was a liability. So our number one cause of sewer overflows in our system is fat, soils, and grease. That's a real liability. We've been able to take that liability and turn it into a productive revenue-producing asset that will save our ratepayers. We're looking at right now about $800,000 in annual energy costs, as well as produce about $340,000 a year in tipping fees from the haulers that bring this fog to us. The outside investments and cost savings and tipping fee income are central to our business case to make this project work. I guess I'd like to close by talking a little bit about kind of the challenges and opportunities that we see. As the governor and the Public Utility Commission and legislature review Oregon's energy policies, it's important to factor in the many benefits these incentives deliver to municipal ratepayers like ours. Oregon's going to be producing more renewable energy, and Oregon's wastewater treatment utilities across the state can be part of that discussion. It makes business sense as our communities invest in clean water infrastructure, and it's also a priority for our customers to look at clean, renewable power. As you look forward to the next session, I'd like you to keep a couple things in mind. One is biogas is a baseload power. The other thing is we, as a utility, we do capital planning on a 5 or 10 year horizon. And stable, predictable state incentives are central to our ability to plan and make these energy investments. The last thing I think I'd call your attention to is our Durham facility is a net metering agreement with PGE that works very well. However, we're artificially constrained by a 2-megawatt net metering cap, which essentially requires us to kind of dial back the engines and flare off gas that we could otherwise be used to produce power that we could use at the treatment plant. I don't know if this is a legislative fix or if it's a PUC issue, but raising that cap could lead to increased renewable power production, reduced greenhouse gas emissions, and further savings for our ratepayers.
Thank you.
Okay, and continuing the theme of different projects of all kinds of sizes and types, I'd like to talk a little bit about the PATU Wind Project. PATU is owned by one of the CREA executive board members, and as you drive through the gorge, of course, you see an awful lot of wind turbines these days, but the PATU project is somewhat unique and shows how a small, independent, private developer, landowner can build a fully functioning, viable small wind project. So, PATU is about 9 megawatts. You can see it. You can see the picture there, located on farmland that was family farmland in Wasco County, completed in kind of at the tail end of the last wind boom in 2010. The project provides a lot of these local benefits that we were referring to earlier. There are about $250,000 for the tax benefits to government, state and local, that come out of the project. About $350,000 a year of other basic professional services of a variety of sorts, and about $300,000 worth of salary and benefits to a number of local people in the gorge. I asked Orman Hildebrand, the owner, to give me an idea of this theme of greater reliance upon local vendors. So he has 58 people that he basically has written or routinely writes checks to, various construction contractors and subcontractors, professional services from wind forecasting to IT. Of those 58, 28 were directly in the Columbia Gorge area, just right there in and around the Dalles Hood River area. Of the 58, 42 were located in Oregon. So, the way Orman likes to describe it is when he needs to buy a pickup truck, he's going to go down to Ernest Motors and buy a pickup truck. If Iberdrola or EDF buys a pickup truck, that may come from a lot of places, which may or may not be a dealer there in the gorge. So, Representative Ritter, and that kind of it goes back to the question that you asked earlier. How do you get these kinds of local benefits? His IT guy is a local guy. His rock contractor was a local guy. They are, as you might expect, as small local residents and businessmen. They just know these local people, develop relationships with them, and those are the people that that benefit from the construction and operation from these projects. So in the interest of time, what I'd like to do now is turn it over to David Brown. I think most of you know Davis. He's somewhat infamous. And he can follow on some comments that both Les and Mark made with regards to what it takes to try to make one of these projects work and what, frankly, are some of the obstacles that developers such as Les and Ormond and Mark face when they're trying to build these projects. So, David.
Thank you, Chair Vega-Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables, and I'm a larger scale solar developer here in Oregon. The principal law that exists to encourage renewable energy is the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, referred to as PURPA, which was enacted almost 40 years ago during President Carter's term in office. And the purpose of the act is to promote greater use of renewable energy. It's a federal law, but it's largely implemented by the states through state legislation and decisions of the State Public Utility Commission. Implementation of PURPA is generally described by the Public Utility Commission as a balance between encouraging renewable energy and protecting taxpayers from higher costs often associated with renewable energy. PURPA is a must-purchase law. Utilities must purchase from qualified renewable energy facilities, or QFs, at prices approved by the PUC that are to reflect the cost to the utility of its next generation resource. So the idea is that a renewable project can substitute for the next resource the utility would buy. That's the general theory behind PURPA, and that cost is called the avoided cost. So QFs get avoided cost. I'm sure you've heard that jargon. That's what it's all about. Most PURPA projects in Oregon are community scale projects, which is purpose a one of the two avenues really open to community renewables right now. In large part, PURPA in Oregon has been a failure. Until this year, there had been less than 1 megawatt of PURPA solar in Oregon, one megawatt for 40 years, out of more than 400 megawatts of solar projects that were formally proposed and had contracts under PURPA. For wind, biomass, and geothermal, the success rate of PURPA is better, but it's only about 1 to 2% of the proposed megawatts actually have been built. PURPA has a very, very low success rate. Recently, there was some good news for PURPA. Avoided costs, which are reset approximately every 6 months, were for a brief time high enough for projects to work, and a number of projects have signed up and A number of them are under construction. House Bill 47, 43. Discussion. Excuse me. House Bill 4037, which this committee sponsored in February, is a small bill that gave a number of those projects a hand up that it was needed. So I've developed 20 projects in Oregon so far, and one is a PURPA project. It just broke ground. I hope to have another that'll break ground by the end of the year, but PURPA has just not been something that's been available to me. A window opened, it quickly closed, but at least for a time, and we are going to get a number of PURPA projects now, but the PUC changed the rules again, and they're no longer economically feasible. There's three reasons, I think, that PURPA doesn't work in Oregon. One, the rules just aren't kept up to date. So the PUC has regulations. If you go to its website, you can read the regulations. A lot of them just don't apply anymore. They've been repealed or changed, but the Secretary of State was never told, the OAR was never updated, and so when you read the rules, they don't apply. And an example is that there's a regulation on the books today that says that utilities will finance interconnection costs at the utilities cost of debt. That's a very attractive regulation, and it would be useful for developers to be able to use it, but it has long since been repealed, even though it's still in the books. Further, the PUC is constantly adopting new rules to govern PURPA, and none of those get published in OAR either. They're published in individual orders in lots of different dockets. There's no convenient way to search those. There's nobody who keeps them together. The only way you can find out is to ask the utilities, gee, what are the rules for PURPA in Oregon? And that's an unusual way to have to do it. Secondly, PUC decision-making PURPA is lengthy, formalistic, and participation is expensive. Instead of rulemaking, the PUC uses what they call investigations, which are run as contested quasi-judicial matters. So they require legal briefs, sworn testimony, cross-examination, an oral argument before an administrative law judge, and this is to adopt a regulation. Only a small handful of people participate in these, other than the utilities which participate in force. And it is extremely expensive to participate because you have to hire counsel. Very unusual to have to hire counsel to testify about a regulation before a public agency in Oregon. Also, if you want to testify, it's hard to know what to testify about because the PUC doesn't propose rules, and so there isn't a proposed rule that you can comment on. The existing rule isn't published in a way that's convenient to find, and what you really have to do is hire one of the handful of lawyers who always publish practice before the PUC, and they give you the inside game. But it's a practice that's very hard for the public to participate in. Third, the administrative rules for PURPA change frequently. There are a number of these investigations that are open. Rates change at least once a year, more often twice a year. There are multiple proceedings open at the same time, and it just is very difficult to try to keep up. And so where does this take us? Well, I've participated with the PURPA process at the PUC for 3 years now, and I've now joined with CREA and a number of other interested stakeholders to bring to this committee this fall a legislative proposal on community renewables that will try to make a balanced proposal with respect to how do we get community renewables in a way that works, that's fair to ratepayers, that encourages renewable energy, that's good for the communities, because as you've heard from these examples, a well-designed community renewables project can provide several value streams besides just electricity, and we need to be able to tap the creativity of people to find those value streams and realize them. But that means we need to have stable rules that everybody can understand and not have litigation about absolutely everything in order to get to a development proposal or to move forward. So we'll be back to you with some ideas on this. And I'm determined to include the utilities, including customer-owned utilities, in the discussion, other stakeholders, and, of course, we will also invite the staff of the PUC to participate if they will. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a quick question for Mark, because I know you've got more things on the agenda. Can you give us an idea of what the lifespan of the generator at that runs on the fog that I looked at is, so that we get a sense for how many years after it's paid for that it provides benefits to ratepayers and customers?
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, our generator that we have at our other treatment plant was installed in 1989. It's still operating. It's not, it doesn't use the fog system. It's just using off digester gas. We're typically looking at a 30 to 40 year window in terms of these facilities if they're maintained properly, and we have a long record of maintaining. And the issue is we have at Rock Creek is that the engine efficiency is not nearly what engine efficiency is now. So typically that's where it hits it. But our board wants us to at least hit 25 years on most of these investments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Vince.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Dave, your last remarks, the whole thing's very interesting to me, but your last remarks about how we might approach better the regulatory scheme we use in addressing these issues is really interesting to me. So when might we see what you have in mind?
So there have been a number of, Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Benz, thank you. There have been a number of discussions that have already begun, and I think that we expect to have something that we can meet with people on, or meet with a committee on, by September. Several of you, yourself, Representative Benz, Representative Reardon, Representative Helm, have asked to get involved earlier, and we're obviously very, very open to that. Frankly, it's never been more exciting to be in the renewable energy business than it is right now. The legislation that was passed in February represented a sea change in the attitude about renewable energy, and the state of Washington is picking up on it. You all can have this. The best place in Washington to put a solar farm is Oregon. There's reasons for that. I'm dead serious about it. But this is a very exciting time to be talking about renewable energy in Oregon. Costs have dropped faster than anyone has expected. And but these community projects, it's where we all started. They're very important if well-designed. The stories you heard are very compelling, and we need to find a way, not to say we're all done with community renewables, but to find a way to do it right.
Follow-up. Well, of course, being a lawyer, I am very interested in the legalities of the rules that apply to the Commerce Clause. Let's get right to it. And figure out, knowing what we have to address when we talk about alternatives to the current systems that we enjoy. And I mean enjoy, because they work. And so I'm not inclined to thrash around and damage that which has been years in the making. But I certainly do want to know what the rules are so that we don't waste too much time getting us up to speed at the very beginning of the next session. So it'd be great if we could work at it during the summer and fall.
So that's a good caution. Excuse me. Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Benz. That's a good caution, and we will take legal advice along the way. Oregon shouldn't be parochial about power, because we have a very long history through the Bonneville system of exporting power. It's power in interstate commerce is good for everybody. We have a very deep amount of wind that we actually export to California. Most of the wind that's generating in Oregon is not used in Oregon. It's exported to California. And that's great economics for the state to have that money come up here. On the other hand, we import a lot of power that we don't really need to, and we should look at what can we do for our policies to see that those large solar projects are built here instead of in Utah or Idaho. And it's a matter of being competitive, not violating the Commerce Clause, but you're right, it's there's a path there, and it's easy to get off of it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming today, and I know we'll be hearing more about this. Like I said, you had mentioned a couple folks who are interested in this. We have Rep. Johnson, Rep. Reardon, who is interested in getting some folks together to continue discussions about what can happen in 2017. So we'll
excellent.
Be reaching out. Thank you.
Okay, we appreciate your time. Thanks.
All right, now we're going to go from energy to air quality. And we're going to start off the discussion with an introduction by the new DEQ interim director, Pete Shepherd. Thank you so much for being here today. We'll give everybody a minute to switch gears. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I am the interim director at the Department of Environmental Quality. Although I'm just a month into what will for me be a temporary return to public service, my 27 years of previous experience in and out of this building teach me the value of brevity. So I'm simply in this appearance right now just going to introduce my colleagues and give you a little bit of a high-level overview of what you'll hear from the remaining panels. I'll come back for a substantive opportunity to talk with you in a second. So the first panel you're going to hear from, three of my colleagues here are going to speak to you about, give you an overview on air quality. And in a sense, they're going to be addressing ambient air in general in Oregon, but with some information about the areas in which Oregon has attained or not attained the standards that the federal government lays down for ambient air quality in different communities. Then I'll return together with two of my colleagues and with the director of the Oregon Health Authority, Lynn Saxton, to talk to you about Cleaner Air Oregon. And in that part of the presentation, we'll be addressing the regulatory reform effort that addresses more specifically individual permittees and the connection of human health to that permitting process. And then the final panelist of one, another of my colleagues from DEQ, will be here to talk about the wood smoke work group and information about that, because as you'll hear during the first presentation, a significant contributor to the difficulty we have in some regions of Oregon in air quality is the fact that wood smoke is a very significant contributor to the problems in those communities, those non-attainment areas. So I'll take my leave and come back in a moment for more substantive
thank appearance. You, Dr. Shepherd. And I do want to thank Representative Taylor and Representative Nose for joining us
thanks
today.
For having us.
Thanks for having us.
They're very interested in this.
Did
I did. Okay. They didn't just show up. Sure. Thank you guys for being here today.
We're not going to vote.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is David Collier, and I manage air quality planning for DEQ. And with me is Sarah Armitage, my lead air toxics staffer for our program. Thank you for the opportunity to kick off our panel and provide you with an overview of DEQ's air quality program. We have a lot to cover today, so our overview will be hitting some highlights, and of course our panelists will be getting into some details. For over 40 years, DEQ's air quality program has reduced air pollution in the state and made Oregon safer. We've had great successes in doing that and restoring Oregon's air to meet federal air quality standards. And in both urban and rural communities around the state, our program has significantly reduced smog, known as ozone pollution, fine particulate, carbon monoxide, and many other types of air pollution to better protect public health. And this is really a great success story for Oregon and our program. And we have a lot more to do. We have several big challenges in the air program facing us. The first two are really fine particulate and ozone or smog. And these are the two areas where we really see the greatest risk of violating federal air quality standards and of triggering non-attainment in communities, a designation under the Clean Air Act, which I'll talk a little bit more about. Oregon currently complies with the federal ozone standard, but the communities of Portland and Medford and Hermiston have levels that are not far below federal standards, and we need to watch that very closely going forward. Oregon has two non-attainment areas for fine particulate, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls, and several communities around the state that are at risk of non-attainment. Air toxics, of course, is an area of significant and serious concern for us. This is a very, very complex field involving many different types of air pollutants and health effects ranging from increased cancer risk to potential neurological damage. And that, of course, is in the center of our radar and our work. We have other priorities, including climate change for the air program, and also protecting visibility in Oregon's scenic areas and Crater Lake National Park. Many of the types of air pollution sources we deal with, like wood stoves and diesel engines, motor vehicles in general, contribute to multiple problems at once. And we'll talk more about multi-pollutant strategies as part of our presentations. The air program, we manage both federal regulations under the Clean Air Act and our own state initiatives to help fill gaps in the federal program and to achieve our own state air quality goals. So generally speaking, in air quality, EPA sets national air quality standards and goals, but DEQ also sets some standards and regulations. We monitor and assess for air pollution impacts. We develop strategies to reduce that pollution. We implement those strategies through our permitting programs and both through regulatory and non-regulatory activities. We assist people with information and with compliance, and we perform compliance and enforcement where we need to. This chart is obviously a greatly simplified view of what all that looks like. And so I'm just going to start on the left and go across. Under the Clean Air Act, EPA sets federal air quality standards for health for what they call criteria pollutants. Those are ones that might be familiar to you, like ozone, fine particulate, carbon monoxide, sulfur and nitrogen dioxide, and lead. And this is the area where Oregon deals with issues of federal non-attainment. We also implement federal and state permitting regulations for both large and small industrial sources through our Title V and our air contaminant discharge permit programs. And that's where we establish operating conditions for facilities. We manage emissions growth from new and expanding facilities. And we implement under the federal air toxics program different emission control technology requirements that reduce both air toxics and some criteria pollutants. Also, Oregon benefits from federal regulations for vehicles and for fuels that result in cleaner cars and trucks and engines. And for example, I might cite the tighter emission standards for new diesel trucks or for lower sulfur in fuels. Under the Clean Air Act, we also have the Regional Haze Program, which I mentioned helps reduce visibility. Helps to reduce haze and improve visibility in wilderness areas. And across Oregon, DEQ has responsibility for all these programs, except in Lane County, where the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency has jurisdiction, and we provide oversight of that program. Whoops, I did that last time, too. So over on the right side of the graph, we also have several state initiatives to fill the gaps in the federal programs and to help Oregon meet its own clean air goals. Our state initiatives fall generally into three main focus areas: air toxics, motor vehicles and transportation, and climate change. So as I've said, air toxics is a very technically complex area, and we've made really good progress in our state to date. But of course, we have a lot more to do to protect public health. Couple of examples. There are no federal air quality standards for air toxics. So over the last few years, DEQ has worked through our expert science advisory panel to assess the latest health and medical research and update our clean air goals for the 52 different air toxics that are most relevant for Oregon. And these are known as our air toxics benchmarks. They are really meant to guide our work to study and reduce air toxics in Oregon. Oregon is one of the few states with ambient clean air goals for air toxics, and we are actually a national leader in this area. Our air toxics program also includes elements for monitoring and health assessment, as well as community-wide and source-specific planning. We operate an incentive-based clean diesel program to reduce diesel pollution where we can. And diesel particulate is one of our most dangerous air toxics in Oregon. And it's also a source of fine particulate and of greenhouse gas pollution. And most recently, we've initiated development of health-based permitting regulations for industrial sources, which will make our state-based approach to air toxics more complete. And you'll be hearing more about that from our panelists coming up. Motor vehicle transportation emissions are one of the biggest sources of pollution we have in Oregon, and we have several state initiatives around that that address motor vehicles. Low emission vehicle program that we have in Oregon ensures that only the cleanest cars come to Oregon, including electric vehicles. And our vehicle inspection and maintenance program helps ensure that as these vehicles age over time, they're maintained to operate and operate at the cleanest design that they were intended to. We have other programs that all deal with transportation and really provide multiple pollutant benefits across both ozone and fine particulate and air toxics. And our transportation strategies are really good examples of multi-pollutant strategies. In the area of climate change, we have several significant initiatives to address greenhouse gases, and those include the Clean Fuels Program, otherwise known as Low Carbon Fuels. That program is designed to reduce the average carbon intensity of Oregon's transportation fuels by 10% over 10 years. So together with clean fuels and clean vehicle technologies, you really have a very complete strategy for reducing carbon and greenhouse gas pollution from vehicles and as well as air toxics and other pollutants. We've been working under the federal Clean Power Plan to reduce greenhouse gases from the electricity sector. Nationally, development of those plans is on pause right now, pending outcome of federal litigation, but may resume in the future. And I'm really happy to say we had developed many positive and collaborative relationships with other agencies and stakeholders in other states around that work. The 2016 legislature tasked DEQ with conducting a study of how market-based greenhouse gas reduction programs such as cap and trade might work in Oregon, and we're working on that study right now. And finally, our greenhouse gas emissions reporting program is where we gather data about the amount of greenhouse gases permitted in this state. Monitoring is at the heart of our air quality assessment and science. And this map, we show just our more permanent statewide monitoring network, which is primarily focused on criteria pollutants like ozone and fine particulate, but also includes two long-term general purpose air toxics trend sites. And our monitoring network is worked out and agreed to every year with EPA. The blue dots here show just our annual sites where we have a long-term presence to monitor for pollutants like fine particulate and ozone and track compliance with federal standards and just track trends. The red triangles represent our summer sites where we monitor for more episodic events like wildfires. We have about 45 air monitoring sites around the state in general, but that can vary by our needs and our funding. We do several types of air monitoring assessment, including short-term studies not shown on that map, that investigate air pollution concerns in specific areas, and Sarah's presentation will touch on that a little bit. We also have monitoring data. We also gather emissions information, and sometimes we'll use computer models to estimate air pollution impacts on communities. One of our biggest challenges is also one of our biggest success stories, and that's helping Oregon communities deal with and avoid violating federal air quality standards and avoid the classification known as non-attainment. Non-attainment means several things. It means that for several days out of the year, the air is unhealthy in the community, and Oregon has had its biggest challenges around ozone and particulate for violating federal standards. Violating federal standards can also saddle a community with the stigma of being regarded as a non-attainment area, which can be a detriment to economic development and of being able to attract new business to the community. Non-attainment triggers a complex array of legal requirements under the Clean Air Act and is essentially been described as a 30-year date with EPA. Once you become non-attainment, that's a planning process that lasts decades. And being non-attainment can also impose more restrictive requirements on local industrial sources in the community. This map provides just a quick overview of where in Oregon we've been successful at meeting and maintaining compliance with the health standards. The green stars show our success stories. These communities have really reduced emissions and come back into compliance with particulate standards and ozone, and that's where we work hard to maintain compliance with standard and avoid going back into non-attainment. The black triangles show current particulate non-attainment areas, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls. We're developing new attainment plans for those areas in partnership with the community and with EPA. To bring those areas back into compliance as soon as possible. The gray areas show areas where that have violated the particulate standard but have not yet been formally designated non-attainment by EPA. And that's where we're working very hard with EPA and in partnership with the community to restore healthy air, bring the particulates down, and avoid going non-attainment. And the white triangles are areas of concern for PM2.5 and ozone, particularly in Burns and Hillsborough. PM2.5 levels have recently bumped up over the standard, but there's no official violation yet. We've also measured unpredictably high ozone levels in Hermiston near the federal standards. So we're currently working on plans in Burns and Washington County to reduce fine particulate, and we're also working with Washington State to explore what's going on in the Hermiston area with ozone. There may be some interstate transport of pollution going on there, all with the goal of really understanding and avoiding that federal non-attainment area designation. And in all these communities, we work very, very closely with all the elected officials and the community leaders to figure out what measures are really going to work best for those communities. While each community is unique, I can say pretty universally across Oregon that excessive residential wood stove smoke is the main driver of non-attainment risk for fine particulate. And that's why we've spent so much time really focused on residential wood heating as a pollution source. And also, as I've mentioned before, as a source of multiple pollutants, including air toxics. To be successful, local governments really need the information and the ability and the resources to engage with their citizens and develop a plan that's really going to work for their community. The communities that we've worked with in Lakeview and in Klamath Falls and in Medford and Grants Pass and across the state have really taken the initiative to reduce the particulate in their community, and I really want to acknowledge their hard work and the great partnerships we have with EPA to try to just solve the problem, make the air healthy, and avoid the federal Clean Air Act pitfalls of non-attainment. As you'll hear more about in our panel coming up, House Bill 3068 tasks DEQ to convene a wood stove work group to explore new ways to help communities deal with wood stove smoke and the risk of non-attainment. And that group's been underway for several months, and we'll be coming to you and talking to you about the outcome of that. So that's, I realize, just a very quick overview of the AIR program and all that's going on. And now I'll turn it over to Sarah to talk about AIR toxics.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Armitage. I work in DEQ's Air Quality Planning Section, and I'm going to give you a little bit more detail about Oregon's Air Toxics Program. So as you can see from the slide, air toxics come from many sources, the majority of which also produce those criteria pollutants that David was mentioning, such as particulate or chemical precursors to ozone and smog. Generally, what we see is that people are exposed to most of the risk from air toxics from what we call area sources, or wood burning and mobile sources, cars and trucks on roadways, construction engines, all of those things put together make up most of our exposure. However, for people living close to industrial facilities, those emissions can also add unwanted increases in health risk, as we've recently discovered near art glass facilities. So this chart shows the elements of Oregon's air toxics program. If you remember the larger flow chart that David was showing you, this just outlines elements of that orange path, which was air toxics only, the state initiative. In purple, we implement federal programs and requirements for industry through permitting. In the green boxes, we use our air toxics benchmarks to assess problems and provide solutions statewide and in impacted communities. And in the blue boxes on the right, we have progressively cleaner engines as EPA sets standards for new gasoline and diesel-powered vehicles. So examples of our current actions to reduce air toxics are in the gray boxes below. Implementing federal regulations for industry has resulted in very significant reductions of air toxics statewide for our largest facilities under Title V permits. And this has been going on for about 20 years. It's also resulted in reductions for a spectrum of medium and smaller facilities under our state air contaminant discharge permits. So some examples of facilities where those federal regulations have required air toxics reductions are things like the larger wood products manufacturers statewide, metals foundries, and vehicle painting businesses, to just name a few. In the past 5 years, EPA air toxics regulations have also applied to many medium and smaller facilities, requiring air toxics controls of businesses like dry cleaners, smaller auto body shops, and metal plating facilities. DEQ partners with industry associations to provide technical assistance to hundreds of smaller facilities each year. To supplement the industrial and engine standards, DEQ uses a geographic approach to assess and solve problems in communities. We monitor for air toxics in communities statewide, and we use computer models to estimate emissions impacts of air toxics. So you may have heard of Portland Air Toxics Solutions. That was our first project working with a community to identify and make plans to reduce air toxics from sources causing the most risk. And we completed this in 2012, and we've been implementing it since that time. Portland Air Toxics Solutions included plans for wood burning, which caused a lot of risk in the community, diesel engines, both on-road and non-road engines, gasoline cars and trucks, and metals facilities, for which it was our goal to simply gather more information to understand their impacts. We also consider actions to reduce air toxics emissions from sources statewide. Examples of these actions are DEQ's Clean Diesel Program, where since 2001 we've provided incentives for cleaner engines, Heat Smart, which requires removal of an old dirty wood stove upon home sale statewide, and our gasoline fueling regulations, which are designed to capture additional benzene vapors when underground storage tanks are filled by the tanker trucks. So under federal clean engine laws, both gasoline and diesel cars and trucks have gotten much cleaner. This causes less ozone, particulate, greenhouse gas, and toxic air pollution. And Oregon has accelerated this process by opting into the California low emission and vehicle standards. So the current situation where we identified metals emissions at levels of concern from the Art Glass facilities has really highlighted what we and others have called a gap or a risk gap in our regulation for air toxics. So this graph roughly illustrates that gap. And if you think of all air toxics in Oregon as being in that larger oval, the whole shape here, this diagram shows coverage of the different regulatory levels we have in our state. So the inner oval shows the body of federal regulations for air toxics. These are the technology-based controls expressed generally in tons emitted per year or in work practices that are required of the industries to reduce toxics. And this is coupled with a federal review of how well requirements protect public health and potential updates of those required controls over the years. The federal air toxics regulations have been very effective at reducing emissions and risk nationally, but they do have limitations. They're very generic in nature. They're not tailored to each facility. They don't require a site-specific risk assessment or risk reduction. So in some cases, the federal standards may adequately control risk, and others they may not. So the second oval, the green ring, shows DEQ's geographically based air toxics program. So that's Portland Air Toxics Solutions or any other community in the future that we work with to understand and reduce emissions. This approach, which we used in Portland Air Toxics Solutions project, evaluates the industrial emissions as part of the whole airshed. So in the whole mix, with cars and trucks and wood stoves and commercial activities and all those emissions. So we use a general model to do that. And in the case of Portland Air Toxic Solutions, which was our first effort to do this, the modeling wasn't really exact enough to understand or control risk to people in neighborhoods close to the facilities. We had a general idea of their impact, but we didn't have very detailed information. And at this point, we're thinking the geographic approach may be better suited to assessing and controlling emissions from area and mobile sources. The outer oval represents industrial air toxics emissions that are not adequately addressed by either federal regulations or Oregon's current risk-based approach. So here's a map showing locations for air toxics monitoring, and the next panel, Brian Bowling, will go into more detail about this, but this will give you a general overview. The blue dots show our two long-term full monitors funded by EPA and Portland and LeGrand. These are also known as our trend sites because they've been going on for a long time. The orange dots show two full-year or longer-term monitors currently located in southeast Portland and one soon to be commenced in the Gresham area in the Rockwood neighborhood. The green dots show locations where we're conducting special studies. These are recent efforts for metals in Portland and for naphthalene in the Dalles. The red and purple circles show locations where we, and in the case of Eugene, the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency, have conducted air toxics monitoring assessments in the past. So over about the last 15 years. The 2016 legislature gave DEQ additional resources for two full air toxics monitors, and these monitors will be in place by the end of 2016. Brian Bowling will give you more detail on this. So here is an example of some of our air toxics monitoring data. These charts show air toxics trends for five key pollutants. So we've picked several pollutants out of many that we could look at. And, you know, they represent emissions from cars and trucks, from industry, from wood stoves, some that form in the atmosphere, like formaldehyde and acetaldehyde. So we've taken those to look at trends. And these charts generally show good news that on a larger scale, emissions of air toxics are decreasing over time. Even though we do see these downward trends for the pollutants on this graph, we know that levels can still be unacceptably high near emissions and emission sources such as industrial facilities or busy roadways. Also, these are only five pollutants. There are many more air toxics of concern than we've shown on this graph. So looking at these, when you look at the vertical axis, it's times above our air toxics benchmarks or our clean air goals. And the five pollutants that we've looked at are stacked in bars for each year to show air toxics trends. The orange line and dots show our targets for air toxics reduction. These are trends we've observed over the years, and we would like to continue. So we've moved the line on down to show what we'd like to see. You can see that levels of these five pollutants are generally about twice as high in Portland as they are in La Grande. Higher levels of air toxics come with density and development, and this is something we see statewide in varying with size of the community. The resurgence of our economy and more vehicle and truck traffic likely shows in the increased levels you see on these graphs for 2012 and 2013. And also we know that meteorology, the weather, has a very huge effect on pollutant concentration from year to year. So stagnant patterns versus unsettled windy weather may explain the drop in pollutant concentrations in 2014 in Portland. We know that this was a year with very good ventilation, lots of stormy weather, few periods of stagnation. So before we move to the next panel and questions for us, I would like to emphasize further good news, in addition to those trends of the last slide, that much of our work really has benefits for multiple pollutants. Traditionally, we've addressed our work one pollutant at a time to meet the federal standards, but now we're thinking more in terms of multi-pollutant benefits. This is a more complex way for us to do our work, but it does have a lot of benefits, including all the partnerships that we can form. On the left side of this chart are some of our key source control efforts, and across the top are the key pollutants that we're seeking to reduce. So because sources of air pollution emit multiple pollutants, our source control efforts are effective for multiple pollutants. For example, cleaner engines and cleaner fuels reduce particulate, air toxics, ozone, greenhouse gases, and pollutants affecting visibility. You can see that wood smoke reduction efforts control particulates, air toxics, and also pollutants affecting visibility. And then when you look at the industrial controls, they have effect on all the pollutants across the chart. So that's all I have, and I would be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Thank you. I think that this is actually a really great slide. I sit on the diesel engine work group that Senator Denbrough is putting together, and the focus of that, because of the legislation that was passed, was really on health impacts for diesel. But, I mean, you can't talk about clean engines without also acknowledging that there's a lot of other factors at play when you do make changes to those. And I think that this is good, and that's something that the legislature should take into consideration as we're looking at, you know, the policies we're passing and the bills we're passing and all the different ways that we could be looking at these impacts.
Brooklyn. Thank you, Madam. I was almost said Madam Speaker. Just sort of came out. Madam Chair. So when you consider these emissions, et cetera, and how you map them and everything, do they reflect the difference in density in, for example, wood stove, just take wood stove, in the area of Portland there might be, I'll just make something up, you know, 1,000 wood stoves. But in that same geographic area, say in eastern Oregon or at the coast or something like that, there would be 100 wood stoves in that same geographic area or less. So how do you account for that, the differences in the different geographic regions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, we do have some data for wood stoves statewide. So what we've done are some surveys over time where we've asked people in different counties about their wood stove use, and we've mapped it by zip code. So we have some pretty rough idea of the distribution of wood stoves, and we also ask information about the model, make, how frequently they use it, how they burn it. So that's where our data source comes from. And then in the case of the Portland area, we've done a more refined wood stove use analysis because we did our Portland air toxic solutions work. There were some remaining questions about, you know, really is this risk all coming from wood burning? And so we did a follow-up survey, and we got even more detailed information about wood burning in the Portland area. So we do have pretty good information, and yes, density makes a huge difference, and also, you know, people in communities, what types of heating sources they use, and we see a lot of variation there too.
And just to follow up on that, so do you differentiate between wood stove burning and fireplace burning?
Yes, we do, actually. When we do the survey, we ask about the different types of heating devices that people use. Oh. And, you know, some people have the freestanding wood stove, some people have fireplace inserts, and then some people have open fireplaces. So we ask questions about all of those things. And we've seen that the fireplaces, when people use them, are pretty polluting. They're fairly dirty sources of heat. However, people don't generally burn them for as long hours as they burn a wood stove. So it's kind of a, you know, a short-term problem. It picks up over the holidays, and also it has impacts during inversions too.
Okay, thanks, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Vega Pearson. Can we go back to the slide 11? I just had a question about the. So it says monitored air toxics trends. And so the monitored question is what I wanted to ask about. How, it's my understanding that we have very few monitors that are up and operating in the state because we haven't given you enough money, not because you didn't want to do that. But so when one reads that, it's I feel that it's perhaps giving an impression that we don't necessarily really know a lot of the information because we don't have enough. I'm learning going through this that we don't have enough monitors, and so but yet we have a slide here that's perhaps saying that we're meeting this target, but yet we perhaps are we at risk of not knowing mm-hmm. enough information to know if we're meeting that target?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, this is a pretty complex area involving collection of data, and also we have other data sources such as modeling that we use statewide. Okay. So when we show these trends, it's always a little bit confusing because, I mean, we are showing, progress over time. And we know that cleaner engines in cars and less benzene in gasoline does result in decrease of air toxics nationally, that this is happening. We see this trend everywhere, and we can show it using our long-term trend monitors in Portland and LaGrande, but those are only two locations, and the chart only shows five pollutants. So it's one indication that we're seeing air toxics go down over time, but we also need to monitor in many more locations to get a full picture of exposure and levels of air toxics. When we look at modeling, we see continued high levels around the state in many communities.
Follow up. Thank you. So if you were to pick what I understand to be the nine metals that folks are talking about as being most serious risk to human health, do you have a chart showing of what the nine metals would be for Portland and LaGrande? I mean, are the stations that you have up and going monitoring those metals, and then would we be able to see the ones that are perhaps the most harmful to the human? I'm just concerned that we don't have a full picture of the data, not because you were trying to hide it or anything, but because you didn't have the funds to do it, to do the work, and I just want to make certain that we're either saying this is the full accurate representation or this is what we know from the limited monitoring that we've done, and then here's the areas that we don't know the adequate information about. I just want to, that's what I'm trying to tease out.
Understood. What I'm showing in this slide is a snapshot of several pollutants that shows levels are dropping for a few pollutants. We have a lot of data statewide from our previous monitoring efforts, and we'll have a lot more data when we monitor in more locations. Mm-hmm. So yes, we can show the levels of those nine metals in Portland and LaGrande, and we can look at those trends over time. You know, what we see on these charts is we don't see much cadmium in LaGrande. We don't apparently have a cadmium source in LaGrande. Mm-hmm. When we look at cadmium and arsenic trends, they also tend to be decreasing, but in the Portland area, cadmium, arsenic, and some other metals are above our health-based benchmarks at levels that are still of great concern to us.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I actually had two questions, but the first one is on slide 5. Go back to that. And I've seen this slide before. I probably asked this question before. But there. Is there a way of calling out the number of people affected by the problem on these slides?
I'm sure there is. Sorry, Representative Benz, that each of the areas that we work in would have the, you know, the population within its urban growth boundary or area affected by the plan.
Right, and so the point is obvious. We have 3,000 people in Burns. We have 3 million people over in the metro area. And so it would seem like there would be a difference in the challenge that's presented by these stars. But star didn't say much, other than we got a problem. So I just want to know how many people are affected, and perhaps the next time the chart is shown, we can call this out. And the degree of alacrity with which we should be addressing some of these issues might be in part based upon how many people are being affected by whatever the problem might be. A follow-up question. The trend line down that we just were looking at, I should have asked the question first on it. It says the Oregon benchmark, and I was surprised the federal benchmark wasn't also on that slide. But of greater interest is what it is that's causing the downward trend. And do we have any clue of why it's going down for real? I guess we could say it's all of the regulations, or perhaps it's because of the downturn in the economy. I don't know which. Do we know?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Benz, this is difficult to know exactly why. The best thing to do is to look at each pollutant and try to understand, are there any changes or federal regulations which have affected that pollutant? So benzene is one we often use because we understand more about it than we do the other pollutants, because we know that clean car standards and better engines have resulted in benzene reductions, significant ones. So that plus the reduction in of benzene in gasoline by about half from 2012 are clear causes for benzene reductions. But there are other pollutants that may not be affected by federal standards, and they may remain relatively stable. It's a complicated world for pollutants because some of them actually form in the atmosphere. So formaldehyde and acetaldehyde and a few other pollutants that we monitor for, they're precursors in the environment that make them. And so those levels have a tendency to stay relatively stable, and I think they'll be harder to affect over time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just had a, Reverend, I'll get to your question in a second, but I just had a follow-up to his first question about the, where he was asking for the population. But it's my understanding that those are areas that are hitting the federal regulations. So those are things where we would have to have a response, the state would have to have a response because of the federal limits, regardless of population.
Right, yeah. Chair Vega-Peterson, that's absolutely right. Wherever in the state we're violating federal air quality standards, we're going to have to respond under the Clean Air Act to make sure that community has healthy air, whether it's 3,000 people or 300,000 people.
Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, and I've had this conversation on this slide at least three times over the years I've been here. And I want it clear. I am just as worried about the people in Burns as all of you folks are about the people in Portland.
Okay.
I want that really clear. What I'm trying to say is there's an impact when someone fires up their barbecue or throws a log on the fire on a lot more people in Portland than out in Burns. I just want that clear. Therefore, we should be more aggressive, I guess, given the fact that people burning wood stoves in Portland are harming more people in our regulatory actions. If we're limited in that, what we can do, and some people have been suggesting that, let's try to save as many people as we can. Doesn't that make sense? Or as opposed to just pointing to the federal standard and saying, gosh, we're all, and of course we are. We need to do something out there. But perhaps our resources are limited. Perhaps they're not. I'm just asking that we show how many people are being affected by this particular challenge. I think it would be helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Rudin.
Thank you. Thank you. Just a couple of questions about the data, and I probably asked this before, but things are happening rapidly. So the data that you have available from whatever sources, whatever monitors, number of monitors we have, how available is that to those in the public that are that want to spend their evenings studying this data? At one time, it was very hard to get.
Right.
So.
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Reardon, we issue an annual report every year of all our data that we collect, and that report's online, so that's available to anyone. I might also just defer to Brian Bowling, who's our monitoring lab manager, who's here today, who can talk more about other ways of the public can access the data, but we certainly make our data available to the public.
Follow up. And that's, you're talking about very broad statewide data or on a specific industry?
Our air monitoring data, I'm talking about primarily through our annual report. Other data on individual sources, I'm not so clear on, Sarah. You know?
Representative Reardon, we do make our permitting information available. Some of that is a little harder to get at than others for the smaller facilities, but you know, people can get a hold of those permits and see what facilities are permitted to emit. So that's available, and there are also other databases. It's not through DEQ, but through the EPA program, the Toxics Release Inventory does provide a lot of information about what chemicals a certain size of facilities use on site and release off site.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I ask is some of my constituents were very concerned. They had a challenge at one time getting information about a certain industry in my district, and it seemed like it just took forever to get the information, so I'm hoping that's more accessible.
Yeah, we hear those concerns, and I think they're part of our considerations in developing our new risk-based permitting program as well, is helping people get more information about the facilities.
And I had a follow-up.
The
second question had to do with the future, so we may not, but just kind of a general direction. If I look at the Lane dashboard, it's kind of like, it's like the air's clean today, it's safe to go outside, it's a nice green pie, or some other days it's probably not quite so good. I think the general public just sort of wants to know, you know, can I go outside today, is it a healthy day, or do I need to keep the kids inside? Are we, you know, someday in the future, could we ever anticipate having something like that for the folks in Burns or in Portland or wherever? So, what are we trying to accomplish?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Reardon, right now we have something we call the Air Quality Index that's on our website that's linked to our monitoring data that can give the public an idea of whether the air is healthy or moderately healthy or not healthy. That those pollutants that are covered there are primarily the pollutants that we have federal standards for, like ozone or fine particulate. It's not really geared around air toxics at this point, but there is a tool, at least available, that the public can look at to get a sense of what the air quality is in their community on any given day.
So that's what's confusing to normal people. It's like air quality index, and I, you know, I'm aware of that,
right?
But it doesn't do the air toxics, so I still don't know whether it's safe to go outside.
Yeah, Representative Reardon, it is challenging to tell people what toxics are in real time because of the way we monitor them. We don't monitor and get results in real time very often. We have to take the samples back to the lab and analyze them. However, there are some new techniques developing and citizen monitoring that connects up to a big database and people can tap into through the web. This is all information that's developing. DEQ is tracking it, and we definitely want to make that available to people as soon as it's reliable information.
Right, but it is difficult to communicate because obviously air pollution is not just one thing. So you can be, you know, have very clean air on for certain pollutants, and you can have challenges for other pollutants. And that's a difficult, it's a challenge to communicate that.
Representative Johnson.
A quick one, thank you, Madam Chair. To look at the Portland chart again, comparing and contrasting, I guess it's the times above the Oregon benchmark from 2004 to 2014 and looking at the downward progression. And just to my And obviously, this is only the toxins that are included on this chart, which is not necessarily conclusive or inclusive of everything. But I guess to my layman's perspective and perception, it would seem to indicate that the air in Portland is quite a bit healthier than it was 10 years ago. Is that a true statement?
Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, yes, we would interpret it that way. We see a downward trend for many of the pollutants. Wow. It's still considerably above benchmarks for many of the pollutants, but we do see a decrease. And in communities like La Grande, they are under a particulate maintenance plan. And so a lot of the work that they have done to decrease particulate has also decreased air toxics in that community.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you guys so much. We have two more panels to continue talking about this, but I appreciate your insights on to the broader picture for air quality. So next, I'm going to call up Pete Shepherd, Lee Felden, Brian Bowling, and Lynn Saxton.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Again, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the interim director at DEQ. Let me very briefly address four specific points. First, to Representative Bence's question about slide number five. I'll work with our folks to see that we incorporate some kind of population density indicator on the slide so that when my successor is here 2 years from now, Representative Bence, at least that much of the discussion will be dealt with in the slide, and you can have the discussion with him or her about the policy implications of that. So I'll make my commitment to you that I'll get that done in my 5 months and 1 week remaining of my tenure.
Question?
Yes.
Well, thank you for that. And I just want to point out, when we had the discussion 5 or 6 years ago on this slide, the issue was one of wood stoves, and we had a limited amount of money that we could use to help people actually change them out. Right. So the question would be, if we're damaging 30 kids in Portland as opposed to one in Burns, well, how many stoves should we give? Now, I don't know the answer. I want them all to go to Burns, okay? Too bad for the 30 kids in Portland. Right. But it might be good for it might be good to have the slide call that out. Well, that was the point.
Madam Chair, Representative Bence, I understand completely. And in my experience, as when I was running the Consumer Protection Program at the Oregon Department of Justice, it's all about triage of the resources that we have available. And the question is, where can we maximize the impact? Now, the issue that you've addressed may be one of an issue that's actually, I'm certain, very familiar to you from your experience in your part of the state, where we're operating under a mandate that's functionally administered by folks from Washington, D.C., much as we are with much of the land in your district, for example. And so this may be an example of a case where the regulator, us, we're responding, trying to respond to the local concern, the need to triage to maximize benefit to all Oregonians, and yet we're operating in some friction with the overall mandate to maintain attainment. So that's the challenge, but at least you'll have a principled basis to have that debate with my successor 2 years from now. The second thing I'd like to say briefly, two things in response to Representative Reardon's questions. First of all, I was very interested in the previous presentation by Dr. Chan, who pointed out that in the world of ocean research, they're getting used to the idea of immediate publication of quality assurance data before it's ready for publication in Scientific American or for peer-reviewed service. And I think that's you're watching at the agency that I now head an evolution of cultural expectation on that very point. And in fact, once a week, we do publish data from monitors that we're collecting around, and that's a new thing. We're doing that in conjunction with Director Saxton's office, and that's a new thing for our researchers. That's not how we previously have thought of the utility of that data, and that's an evolving process. And I hope you'll give me at least 5 months and 1 week to try and effect some change in that cultural expectation about the agency. Second response, again, sparked by Representative Reardon's question as to whether there will be days when warnings are issued. The problem with toxins is they're invisible. We don't see them, and yet they can have a very significant and potentially even very localized effect on a community or even on a neighborhood. But But in a little bit, your question is, in a little bit of a way, it's back to the future. I grew up in Eugene, and I remember distinctly in my days before the formation of DEQ, many days when in the summertime we were advised to stay inside because of the combination of uncontrolled burning from many different sources. So it would not be extraordinary. I think we've made great progress on that, and hopefully we don't get to the stage where we have to issue those kind of warnings. But that's not a place that would be unfamiliar in total to all of us. So I guess I'll stop there with the specifics, and let me just briefly describe a little bit more of this gap that has been described to you earlier, because that's precisely the area in which Cleaner Air Oregon, the work that we're currently doing and that my colleagues here will be able to tell you a bit more about, that's precisely the area in which we're working and trying to improve the situation. And in a nutshell, that gap is that our current emission levels for individual permit programs, that whole host of our regulatory responsibility that's associated with the issuance and enforcement of permits, that those permitting levels are fundamentally calibrated to the volume of emission and not necessarily to the effect of those emissions in terms of toxins, either on the community generally or even more significantly on the particular location or neighborhood. And so the whole point of Cleaner Air Oregon is to see if we can develop through a very elaborate process, which is nothing more ultimately when you strip it down to its bones than a standard rulemaking process, though it has some very important additions to it that my colleagues and I will touch on very briefly. But the point of that whole process is to see if we can, for the first time, create a set of permit-specific regulations that expressly accommodate the fact that we know that some of the emissions contain toxins that have the potential to be very, very significant in terms of public health and even on individual health. That's not the system we have now. That's the goal that we're hoping to achieve through Cleaner Air Oregon, a regulatory reform process that Governor Brown launched and that will not yield its final result for roughly 18 months. The underlying principles of that effort are threefold, and I think they're very important to reinforce for you. The first is that it must be a science-based effort. We're going to bring to bear the best we can, best scientific advice, best scientific information we can. The first step in the process is the establishment of a technical advisory group, which is a group of folks who are experts in the fields that we think may be relevant to the committees, to the ultimate product. But it must be science-driven from start to finish. The second thing is that we're going to bring to bear the best principles of public health, and that is why the Oregon Health Authority is such a critical component, and why Director Saxton is here to speak to her agency's participation in this process. And by public health, I mean the net improvement in public health, which includes, in my judgment, the reality that an employed family is healthier than an unemployed family. And so, in my judgment, the focus on public health necessarily must take into account the total outcome of the rulemaking process. And then finally, I think the third fundamental characteristic of the effort, and this is where I'm going to turn it over to Director Saxton, is that this is pioneering a new form of partnership between two of the state agencies over which you have oversight responsibility. In the area of regulating water, our standards are health-based, and they do directly engage us with OHA in many ways in a direct partnership. In the regulation of air, that's not true, hasn't been true yet. And OHA's role has been to, in an advisory capacity, in the formulation of our current regulatory scheme. In this effort, in Cleaner Air Oregon, Director Saxton's agency and mine are developing a new kind of partnership. And again, that's an evolving process that's evolving right now before your eyes as oversight and before mine and Director Saxton's eyes as responsible for our agencies. Our respective personnel are learning how to work with one another in a partnership that really we haven't ever done before. And I think that's in the best interest of Oregon and Oregonians. It's the most efficient way to spend our money, but that's what we're doing. So I want to turn the podium over to Director Saxton and ask her to offer remarks.
Thank you, Director Shepherd, Chair Vega-Peterson, and members of the committee. I'd like to just touch on three key components of our work with DEQ in Cleaner Air Oregon. First is, as Director Shepherd has mentioned, this collaboration, which is now 4 or 5 months in unfolding and has already produced, I think, many advantages to the people of Oregon in terms of the integration of environmental standards and health standards. Our goal is clear. Oregon's air toxic regulations are going to be aligned with health considerations. Health-based limits on air toxics will be incorporated into the permitting and enforcement process. And again, I think Cleaner Air Oregon provides us really a unique opportunity to work together with DEQ in a new way, both to integrate policy but also contribute to the integration of the science and the expertise and the data to produce a regulatory model that supports air quality for all Oregonians. The Oregon Health Authority's mission is to serve and ensure the health of all Oregonians. Secondly, I want to talk about our role specifically in health-based rulemaking for industrial emissions. Our agency knows that poverty is one of the number one health risks in our state. We can't have healthy people if we don't have employment opportunities, access to quality health care, and communities that support health through best practice regulatory frameworks. Health-based regulations that shape permitting and enforcement and rely on data, science, and evidence will ensure our air meets Oregonians' needs and is very much part of the DNA of the agency in terms of using science and metrics to drive to best practice performance standards. Our new rules will strengthen the role of science. I want to specifically touch on the ability to assess health effects. Our health experts will review DEQ air sampling data in relation to health safety standards, as we have been doing throughout the last 4 to 5 months, and inform the community about potential short-term and long-term health effects. OHA and DEQ will recommend actions for local and state policymakers or address short-term threats directly. For example, if concentrations of metals in the air spike to levels that could cause short-term health problems for people, we're going to exercise our emergency health powers to respond as we did last week, and as we had been signaling throughout this process we would do in the event of an indication of immediate concern. And finally, we're going to move to best practice, building on the experience of other states. The study of that work is already underway in both agencies. It's important, we have the slide up on that shows kind of why we use public health assessments, what they do and what they do not do. I'm not going to read the slide to you. Obviously, why we use them is outlined on the left. It's important to note, however, that these assessments, though they offer broad overview information about contaminant exposures in geographic areas, they cannot determine why specific health issues occur. And this issue has come up numerous times in the last few months with regard to the glass manufacturers. But this is due to personal health exposures and other factors known to be associated with illness. It's due to the lag time between possible exposures and the occurrence of illness. And finally, it's due to the in-migration and out-migration for the people who live, work, or visit an area of interest. OHA remains committed to creating air quality standards that support health wherever Oregonians live, work, play, and learn, and we're enthusiastic about the opportunity before us in Cleaner Air Oregon to provide state-of-the-art best practice regulatory frameworks that provide certainty for our communities and for our employers across the state.
Madam Chair, I'm going to take advantage of the passage of the microphone in this direction to go back to, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Rep. Taylor had that question.
Thank you, Chair Vega-Peterson. Obviously, I think all of you know that I represent the area that I represent in the state, in House District 41. And And I'll let Representative Noe speak for himself, because obviously he's representing House District 42. And you know as well as I do, we have a lot of very, very, very unhappy constituents. And one of the main things, because I go to, literally now I can't even count how many forums I go to and how much time working on this issue, is the state's response and how long it's taking. I understand DEQ's rulemaking process. I also know of several other agencies where it doesn't necessarily take that long. And I know you're have inherited this situation, Director. However, what is being done to shorten the rulemaking process so that it does not take 18 months? And within that, what is being done to at least prioritize some of the more important issues that folks are so concerned about? What can we do to speed it up and so the public can feel a little bit more assured about what they're breathing?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, that's a fair question, and so here's the reason that it's an 18-month process.
No, I know what the reason is. I'm asking what is being done. Is there anything being done to shorten it?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, no, and the reason is that we want to design a process that we're confident extends to all Oregonians and maximizes the opportunity for Oregonians to engage in what will be a truly revolutionary change in the way that we regulate air. And so we could run a rulemaking process that is very accelerated. The Administrative Procedures Act would allow us to, I forget what the minimum amount that the Attorney General says, I think the fastest that they say in their manual is something like 120 days or something like that. But the cost of doing that would be to exclude Oregonians from opportunities to participate in the formulation of those rules. And one of the concerns that, and I've been to some, not nearly as many of the meetings as you have, but I've been to some of those even in the time I've been here. And one of the very grave concerns, I think, about the work that regulators are doing is that it hasn't been sufficiently transparent as people have perceived it. And we want these rules to be, the yield of these rules to be arrived at through a process that, for example, we can push out into, we have four regional meetings scheduled in districts all around the state. And we want to create opportunities for Oregonians to go to those meetings after hours so that people who have ordinary working day jobs can get there and say their piece about what they think the rules should be formed. And that's not just for show to say that we can check the transparency box. Substantively, it's because fellow Oregonians are going to have ideas about how to shape these rules in a statewide way that makes sense for all Oregonians in all districts. So, Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, that's the reason that the rulemaking process is longer, and I get it that it's frustrating to people. Let me speak to the immediate concern, though, and that is that Director Saxton and myself are completely committed to doing everything we can within the limited authority, the limited gap authority, for example, that we have, to apply all the tools we can creatively to respond to conditions where we have a demonstrable and urgent need to protect public health. And that's what we did last week. We invoked a statute that in modern times had never been invoked before. And we're going to keep doing that on the opportunities we can. We deeply appreciate the legislature's commitment to help provide us with additional resources, as you did in the short session, and as I hope you will do again tomorrow before the emergency board, when I hope you will approve our request for additional funds for additional monitors. Because the additional monitoring, Representative Taylor, is how we can focus in on areas of concern to determine when there is, in fact, an imminent threat to a vulnerable population, such as kids, where we can invoke the fairly limited tools that we have to take an immediate action. So I understand that's not a completely satisfactory answer, perhaps, but that is the straight answer to your question about why it's taking that long.
Chair, members of the committee, I would also mention that the monitoring, which has been going on for the past 4 to 5 months, continues. Nothing stops during this process, and we have throughout, I think we've demonstrated agility throughout the last 4 to 5 months in adding resources, in being very in the moment with both the data, the scientific accumulation of the information, and then, as we did last week, responding. And that continues throughout the 18 months.
Thank you, Chair Vega-Peterson. I just want to make more of a comment that the environment is toxic where we are because folks are so upset. And when they hear this, they're going to put more pressure on local government to come up with their own air quality system. That's the side parallel path. There's a big difference between 120 days and 18 months. So if there is something that could be done, again, for the things that are the most dangerous, even if they were temporary rules, something. But having it based not just willy-nilly, of course, because some manufacturers are obviously very, very responsible. The e-board request, which I've been an advocate for, just so everybody knows, is for two monitors, which is great, but that's hardly sufficient for the state. So it's just more of a comment than a question. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and continue with the presentation,
because
we have another panel to get through.
Very well. Madam Chair, I did want to say, as the microphone passed, that the fourth thing I heard from the earlier presentation related to Representative Taylor, we'll see what we can do to produce a chart similar to the ones you saw on slide 9 or 11 that includes all of the 9 metals as you requested.
Mm-hmm. So. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Shepherd, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Leah Felden, and typically at DEQ, I manage the Office of Compliance and Enforcement. And I am currently, newly, temporarily, the Special Advisor to Director Shepherd for Cleaner Air Oregon. And I'd like to tell you very briefly a little bit about the public engagement process that we have for this industrial air toxics regulatory reform. Also known as a rulemaking, and what you can expect out of that process. Both Director Shepherd and Director Saxton have spoken a bit about what Cleaner Air Oregon is and the importance of the two agencies working together. To add to that, Cleaner Air Oregon is really a mandate to the two agencies that we use our expertise, in other words, science and health, to inform the industrial air toxics regulations. DEQ and OHA are creating many opportunities for the public to be heard during this rulemaking process. This slide shows the key forums where the public and interested stakeholders will have an opportunity to get involved. After I describe these events, I'll show you a visual timeline for the rulemaking. We are proposing what we consider to be an ambitious schedule, although I do recognize that for many it does seem like a long schedule. So I look forward to explaining a little bit about what we're doing with those 18 months to you. This month and in June, Cleaner Air Oregon will hold two important interactive webinars. The first webinar is on May 26th, and it's an educational and interactive webinar inviting the public to learn about industrial air toxics regulation in Oregon and the rulemaking process, with technical experts from DEQ, the Oregon Health Authority, and EPA. Participants in the webinar will be able to ask and have answered in real time questions, and the recorded event will be available on cleanerair.oregon.gov for later viewing. The second webinar in June will also be educational and interactive, with experts to present Washington's and California's approaches to human health risk-based regulations for industrial emissions, followed by an opportunity for Q&A as well. Part of this process is includes us looking at other states' models. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We want to look at other states' models and see what has worked and what might work for Oregon, and maybe a combination of those models. During June and July of this year, a technical work group of subject matter experts in environmental, public health, and related fields will tackle the technical aspects of this rulemaking, such as risk assessment and pollutant concentration modeling, and provide an opportunity for the public to learn about the technical considerations that will guide the new rules. In September and October of 2016, public policy forums will be held at four locations around the state, where DEQ and OHA staff will present policy topics, followed by an opportunity for the public to provide comment. During October and November, an appointed advisory committee will convene to advise, recommend, and provide comments to DEQ and to OHA on draft rules, incorporating the public comment that we've heard to date and the work of the technical work group. These are public meetings with time designated for public feedback, and we are currently asking for input on the makeup of the advisory committee, and will then solicit applications from those who wish to serve on the advisory committee this summer. In February and April of 2017, a fiscal advisory committee will meet to discuss and make recommendations about the fee structure that will be associated with these new permitting rules, as well as approve a fiscal impact statement. Based on all this information, DEQ and OHA will continue to revise draft rules and open a public notice and comment period slated for May through July of 2017. And during that period, there will also be a public hearing as required by the model rules. From August to October 2017, we will review the public comment, respond, and publish the comments on the web. And the agencies may, of course, revise the rules based on the comments we receive. In November, our recommendations for the proposed rules will be published and available on our website. And in December 2017, we will propose the rules to our Environmental Quality Commission. Throughout the rulemaking process, we will partner with groups and individuals from across the state to ensure a robust and inclusive engagement process that connects with all Oregonians. Here is the visual timeline that I mentioned and just wanted you to have in your materials. I realize that it's a very busy slide, so I didn't want to just leave that up while we were discussing the important elements of the process. I'd also mention that we have our new website that you've heard about, cleanerair.oregon.gov, and that will be updated regularly with information on the rulemaking process. And that's also where people can sign up for updates and get information on the process and provide input. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about this process. And after that, I'll turn it over to Brian Bowling, our lab manager, to tell you about the monitoring efforts that are underway for Cleaner Air Oregon. Thank you.
Afternoon, Chair Vicka Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Brian Bowling. I'm the Laboratory Program Manager for the State of Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I oversee the laboratory resources for the department, approximately 70 staff that are housed in Hillsboro that include field staff for both air quality and water quality that go around the state collecting samples, bringing those back to our laboratory to process, where we have approximately 25 chemists operating everything from technical metals analysis to organic analysis to dioxin analysis for the state. Today, I'm going to try to answer some questions that have come to us around what we're doing for monitoring, what we've done in the past, why does it take so long for our monitoring, what's going on with the MOS study, where are we monitoring now, and where are we monitoring next. This particular picture shows you one of our full air toxics monitoring sites in North Portland, and to note is the different type of equipment that's sitting on top on that deck. Each parameter, each group of compounds we look for requires a different monitor. And so it can be confusing at times when we talk about monitors and monitoring. With air toxics, we are talking about a different monitor for every class of compound. We started air toxics monitoring back in 1999 with sites around Portland. Since from 99 to current, we've had some ebb and flows in the number of monitors that we've had throughout the state. We've had as many as 7 monitors to as low as 2. We currently have 2 federally funded air toxics monitors in North Portland and 1 in La Grande. And we had up until the short session, we had 2 generally funded air toxics monitors. And in the short session, we received funding for 2 additional. So at this point, we have 4 air toxics monitors. These are full air toxics monitors that are deployed for a year period of time throughout the state at different locations. Why does it take so long to do air toxics analysis? Unlike ozone or particulate where there's a monitor at a site. It sends the information directly to us. It's a real-time monitor giving that information. We have to go out to these sites. We have to pick up filter media. We have to bring that filter media back to the laboratory, and we have to process the samples. This requires time for our field staff to go out there and collect them, and it takes anywhere from a couple hours to weigh a filter when it comes in to a couple days in order to process a filter to do metals analysis or do combustion byproducts, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons analysis. So each of those just requires a lot of time. It requires a lot of staff time. There isn't the real-time monitors available for air toxics, which makes this very challenging, and it makes it very expensive, and why we don't have, like, our particulate monitoring and what drives our air quality index. We have approximately 45 sites that are driving the air quality index. We have 4 air toxic sites, and through that, we have very limited sites, meaning we have limited data sets. So we depend on modeling and other mechanisms to tell what's going on. And we use this information to see how well the model is doing and focus on the areas of concern. In this particular picture at the top left, you see 2 different types of monitors that we have. In the middle picture is a trailer. One of the things that we received back in 2014 was we were down to 1 generally funded air toxic site. We received another one in 2014, which was for the Swan Island air toxics. When we did that site, we knew the importance of moving these sites around. And so we moved from having a fixed location building to putting these onto trailers so that we can move them around a little bit easier. These trailers require power to be dropped, so it's not something that's very easy to be done. All of these monitors require power. It includes a MET station or meteorological station where we collect the wind and directional data. At the bottom, you see your staff.
I wanted to just give you a heads up. You have about 5 minutes.
Yep.
Okay.
At the bottom, we have where we have our staff processing samples. So all of these, again, require them to come back to the laboratory. Okay. So the question is, what changed with the Moss study? So the Moss study was a valuable study. It was 346 sites throughout Portland where they went and collected moss and analyzed that moss for a slew of compounds. They've shared 5 compounds with us, being cadmium, nickel, selenium, lead, and arsenic. And it allowed us to look at hot spots in the area of what was going on with these particular metals. On the right, you can see a cadmium map that was generated from the Moss study. While the study was very good, it allowed us to get close in proximity because these Moss locations were 1 kilometer apart, something that we aren't able to do with air toxics samples. What it didn't tell us is health effects. The Moss concentration doesn't have any correlation with direct health effects. It's simply what is the metal in the Moss. What that requires us to do follow-up. It requires us to do follow-up analysis for additional Moss and air collection around these particular hotspots. And that's what we're undertaking right now. That's the work that we have started. We've prioritized the 5 metals that they've provided to us and started to work on the cadmium, nickel first, and we have deployments in those areas. So currently, we're in 6 different areas doing toxics analysis. We're in southeast Portland. We have 4 metal sites running every single day. This is much different than what we've done in the past, where we've had a full air toxic site pulling a sample 1 in 6 days. Our field staff are out there every single day at these 4 locations pulling filters and bringing them back to our laboratory. We've had 5 hexachrome monitors up around the area looking at the hexachrome values. In addition, we have southeast Portland that we're doing where there's 3 metal sites, and then north Portland where there's 4 metal sites. What we've done here in Hayden Island, we're looking at hydrogen sulfide and VOCs. Multiple locations looking for the same thing. One of the things that we have learned through this effort is we can't put up full air toxic sites at all of these locations. So we prioritize the monitoring to analytes of concern. What is it that we feel is there, and let's monitor for that because that's the knowledge that we have. And that's what we're doing in the Dalles as another example where we know there's an issue with naphthalene. We're deploying 3 monitors for naphthalene. by deploying multiple monitors in these near source, what we call near source locations, we can get a better idea of what is coming from the source. So in the case of the south, inner southeast Portland, we have four monitors surrounding the facility along with a meteorological station. So we can look at the wind patterns on a particular day to the concentrations on a particular day, correlate that along with production records from the facility to understand exactly what may be coming from the facility and what is coming onto our monitors. What are we doing next? So we are currently in follow-up mode of the moss study. We've prioritized the first five, but we know there's additional moss coming in June. All of U.S. Forest Service's data will be coming to us, and we'll be reprioritizing our work to understand other hot spots that may be coming. In addition, we're deploying a Southeast Portland full air toxic site that starts June 1st. We'll be deploying our Gresham site starting in October 1st, and the two new sites by the end of this year still to be sited. It is important to note that those sites will be looking at statewide and going statewide with those air toxics full sites. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions. There are two really short ones. So what does a monitor cost?
So a full scope monitor is one monitor for, say, volatiles organics is $5,000. To do a full air toxic site, you're talking about $75,000 between all of the different monitors necessary in order to do that.
Second question. It's really fast. Mm-hmm. What would be an optimal number to have, right? So I think I understood you have four things going at the moment. If you could have a lot more or some more, what would you seek to have?
It's about time. How long are you going to take to rotate around to look at all the areas of interest? We have a pretty extensive list of areas that we would like to deploy monitors. And I can't say if six or 12 would be the best number. It's about how long to get around to all of these different sites. What I can say from a employee and staff level, we're maxed out. With the monitors that we have and the staff we have, we're producing data as quickly as we possibly can. We've never ran at this pace before, and we're full in. At this point, running this many monitoring locations.
Madam Chair, Representative Nose, it's that triage thing again. If you ask me as the agency head, how many monitors can we use? Could we put to use if we had enough people to operate them and operate them effectively? I could give you a really, really, really long list. And I think that list is probably going to get bigger as we get deeper into the regulatory process. So we're trying to be responsible about what we ask for and still ask for the things we most need, hence the emergency board request. We're trying to anticipate in our agency request budget whether this process will necessitate the very question you raise as to what additional resources, if any, will this additional scheme require of us. But I have to tell you, every state agency, I suspect, would tell you the same thing. We're all going to ultimately, at some level, have to be triaging the application of the resources that you provide to us and the discharge of the functions that you assign to us. And so I guess I would add that to what my a long-suffering lab director has already said about how hard these folks are working. And I just want to say how proud I am of the work that my new colleagues have been doing. The lab is not the only place that's been working hammer and tong on these issues. And they've been very accepting of this outsider who's been parachuted into their midst. And it's been a great experience. And I found a whole lot of dedicated public servants who are trying to do the best by the state.
Thank you. And from my understanding is that somehow the U.S. Forest Service decided to do this, so, and that's how it was discovered, and then you guys get involved because it affects us. But how did they, is this something they do anyway, or, and how did they decide to test this moss? And then you just said, I think, that then we would go statewide and start looking around. I mean, isn't that going to just exacerbate this problem of too little resources to do what, I mean, you may uncover a real Medusa's head here.
Well, the moth study allowed us, they've done this in the forest. They've been doing this in the forest. It was really first of using it in an urban setting to look at air pollutants. The nice aspect of this is I can have five air toxics monitor and kind of think about where to put them and put them up and look. The moss allows us to go in and do something relatively quick, relatively inexpensive in a way for metals, because it's very specific that for metals, there's a couple other compounds that might work with, but really get to the root of, hey, we may have a problem here. And in a very tight location also. Our air toxics monitor, if it wasn't in the particular area of our glass manufacturer, if it wasn't down the street from it, we may not have seen it.
Right.
Where the moss, because you got a tighter pattern of sampling, will allow you to identify these particular things. So part of what we are doing as DEQ in our laboratory is we're doing knowledge transfer with U.S. Forest Service and working collaboratively to better understand how they did it so we can use the tool, but also to understand how do we get this to what is background in moss, what is a better connection to human health, and can we, quote-unquote, calibrate the moss to be more informative of health standards. And there's a lot of research that needs to be done in order to use the tool in that fashion.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Thank you all very much. We have one more person on the air quality, which is Rachel Cicada, who's going to be talking about wood smoke and specifically the wood smoke work group that's been taking place. So, Rachel, if you would mind, we've had some good background information, I think, on air quality and the importance and where the monitoring has happened. Since we have limited time, if you could focus on the actual work group and what they've been doing.
No problem.
Thank you.
So, good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Cicada. I'm an air quality planner at DEQ, and I am the lead staff person for the DEQ Wood Smoke Work Group. And I was just going to say, I know you've had a long day, so I was going to try and wrap it up in about 5 minutes. And let's see here.
Yes, we still get to
load it up.
Yeah, 5:15.
Yeah.
Don't want to say goodbye to you. Just not yet, but you'll visit for you today.
So, as you've heard, we've talked a lot about wood smoke, why it's a concern. It's got particulate matter, air toxics. It's wintertime residential wood burning. It's a significant source of fine particulate. We have a number of communities that are either violating the standard, such as Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge, or at risk of violating the standard. I just also wanted to point out really quickly, this is the PM standard that we're talking about. And as you can see, the levels have increasingly gone down over the years. The last revision has reduced it by half. And so because of that, it's made it difficult for past and non-attainment communities to stay in compliance, and it has put new areas at risk of non-attainment. So I'll get straight to the bill. So because of the growing concern about the health and economic effect of wood smoke in communities across Oregon, Representative Johnson here sponsored House Bill 3068. The bill was geared to tackle issues facing these at-risk communities through a study specifically to examine wood smoke in these communities. And so a number of topics that the workgroup has focused on included ways to reduce wood smoke, exploring options for switching out old wood stoves for cleaner burning devices, looking into the use and production of biomass fuels, and options for reducing the cost of wood stove alternatives during poor air quality days. And all this will result in recommendations for legislation or funding requests to you, the legislature, by September of this year. So I just want to point out some of the workgroup members. The members reflect a range of stakeholders affected by wood smoke and biomass, including those from rural and urban communities, since we knew that this was a concern of the committee. The map here shows a representation of the workgroup, and we've held 4 meetings so far. We have a number of elected officials, such as the Lake County Commissioner, the Mayor of Oak Ridge. We also have the Director of Klamath County Public Health. City manager of Prineville. And so these are all folks who are representing different parts of the state. I also want to point out the city of Hillsborough as well as Washington County Public Health. We have a number of environmental organizations such as Oregon Environmental Council and businesses such as Collins Company and the Port of Portland because these are companies that are impacted by non-attainment.
And then we've also got biomass and hearth products representation, such as Bear Mountain Fuels, Bear Mountain Forest Products, as well as the Hearth Patio and Barbecue Association, as well as a number of state agencies who are helping us plan and research the issues. So the group has had a lot of really good information and information sharing and great discussions with real-world examples and realities of how communities are trying to tackle this issue of wood smoke in their communities. And it's also, they've talked about what will and will not work, such as an acknowledgement that there's a strong culture of wood stove use, that there's an easily accessible wood supply, that there's a lack of staffing to implement programs, and economic barriers to struggling communities. And so it has led to a vision of what is needed to be successful in tackling the wood smoke issue and helping these communities. So all the work group members basically agreed that a key piece of wood smoke reduction efforts must involve increased community funding, which would allow them to fully fund a dedicated local staff person year-round in each community. Now, over the past decade, community support funding has been reduced, and the funding currently provided is simply inadequate to support all the work that needs to happen in these communities across the state. And this funding comes from money that is provided by the legislature, which DEQ then passes through to the communities. And so with this key recommendation, the local staff person in each community would be able to spearhead any local air quality program year-round, including providing information and assistance, coordinating wood stove curtailment, wood stove replacement, and home weatherization. And another key part would also be to have this person help write grants to help fund changeouts, do education efforts, plus additional projects. And the person could try to obtain these grants through federal, state, private, or philanthropic organizations. So communities indicated that knowing that there is a consistent and sustained funding to help with their work would make it easier for them to budget and to solicit grants and matching funds to buttress their work. So by focusing on local community funding, it allows the community to immediately engage to bring the PM 2.5 levels down. And as a next step recommendation, the work group also supported a wood stove changeout program with funding. Now, this would help provide a long-term approach for a community to address wood stoves, and communities would need to submit a proposal of how they would implement the program and identify funding partnership opportunities. Each changeout would span 2 years to allow the community to get the program running, and at the end of the project, a report would be provided to the legislature regarding the program's effectiveness and lessons learned. This is designed to be a sustainable program with a reoccurring ask for funds every 2 years. One of the other recommendations that came out of the work group was to conduct a further study of biomass fuels, specifically biobricks or biologs. Mm. And for those of you who are unfamiliar about what a biobrick or biolog is, they're basically compressed wood fuel. So they're made of compressed sawdust, and they're roughly 2 inches by 4 inches or 6 inches. Some of them are a little bit larger. And these can be burned in a wood stove along with firewood. And so the work group discussed the potential for biobricks to be a lower cost emission option for households to utilize, particularly during these poor air quality days. However, additional research is needed to understand the emissions and safety characteristics of these biobricks, and they recommend conducting a biobrick study to gather information on this promising source of fuel. So another recommendation that they had was to fund supplemental projects if funding is available and can be matched by other funds. And so these supplemental projects could include a firewood exchange where residents turn in green wood for wood that has been properly seasoned, so wood that's been sitting out for at least 6 months to get all the moisture out, a heating fund to assist residents who must rely on alternate sources of heat because they cannot use their wood stoves during poor air quality days, and a wood stove bounty program that provides cash amount for any old uncertified wood stove that is turned in. And communities could utilize options for these strategies to be implemented in their communities in addition to any education, curtailment, or change-out programs underway. So overall, what we heard from the work group was how important it was to build upon and package these recommendations together to really be effective in these communities. So in conclusion, DEQ is going to be taking the work group's recommendations on a roadshow across the state to solicit feedback and hear any additional suggestions that should be brought back to the work group for consideration. And basically, here's a map of all the communities that we're going to be going to. And we're selecting communities that have dealt with wood smoke issues in the past.
And then we'll take these thoughts and wrap up with a final work group meeting this summer. And then DEQ can finish the report and submit it to you by September of this year. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much. Questions?
And I'm not trying to be snarky today, but this is yet again another map with nothing from the coast. And
you can take Brussels off the list.
What's the point?
We're used to.
But I just like to bring that up. If there's going to be the report back to the legislature with the anticipation of providing input from these meetings from around the state to, promulgate rules or whatever, I just think that some people at the coast would like to have a word in. So. And not just Newport. That seems to be the only coastal city used anymore.
Yeah, Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the report, and thank you for the update earlier today that you and Palmer provided. I guess as I look at the process, I've got good confidence in your process. I like the inclusiveness of the people that participated, and I think as you go around on your little tour, I think you'll get some good input there. So I look forward to seeing what you'll have for us in September and what that may segue into for next session. So thank you.
Yeah. And I would just second that. Would look forward to hearing the full report in September, getting some updates on that. And are there any questions? Oh, Rep. Reardon, yeah.
Just a quick question. Thank you. Was there any discussion of energy efficiency tied in with this, so that they're using less energy?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, in terms of energy efficiency, yes, we've certainly talked a lot about home weatherization and how key that is to making a wood stove program work, because if you put a brand new wood stove into a house but it's still leaking air everywhere, it's utterly useless. So we really emphasize making sure that we can couple with any home weatherization efforts.
And actually, that's a good segue. So thank you so much for your presentation. Like I said, we'll look forward to more in September.
Madam Chair, I have to say that my colleague here reminded me that the reason we don't see it from the coast is because we have perfect air at the coast.
But you're very
all floats our way.
Yes.
What's that?
To the valley. Yeah. Committee and guests.
Thanks for
in September,
us.
We were, I'm talking about putting together the agenda, looking at September. There'll be some reports that'll be due. I've also been in talking to folks about having some informational hearings on energy efficiency. So if you have other ideas or things that you're interested in us covering in September, please let me know. With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting and close the committee.